I'd like to convene the Finance Committee and members. We are one away from a quorum, so what I'll do is ask Representative Ashton if you would begin the overview of the bill and hopefully we'll catch the midpoint there and a quorum number will walk in the door. I can understand why we're getting the chart a little bit slower this morning.
I'm just, Mr. Chair, I'm not tracking. I don't know if why we'd be short, but...
Oh, and we've got our quorum. I knew it would become second to the chair. So if I can just hold you there for a moment. Members, the minutes from our previous minutes are meeting are in the pack that the Secretary of State okay, Representative, of the minutes from March 31st, 2008, any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carries. On our vote by Representative Murphy. Representative Rule Covina.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
I'm asleep. Am I supposed to make a motion? Oh, this is my friend here. Okay. Sorry,
he must be talking about you.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the higher case of us for the commission report for Senate file 2402 versus unofficially voted.
The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate File 2402 then be recommended to pass and placed on the general.
Okay, the motion is before us. And by the way, Representative Atkins, I'm not sure what will happen this morning. You haven't been before the committee before.
Oh, really?
Is that correct? If you're not sure, you're better off saying yes.
I think that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. Representative Burns was here last week, and his colleagues and his caucus had an opportunity to initiate him. I don't know after last night if we're up to those same things this morning or not. But the bill is before us, so Representative Atkins, would you care to walk us through the bill?
I would be happy to, Mr. Chair, and before I start, I will ask at the end that when the motion is renewed, if it is renewed, that we be sent to the consent calendar, and I first want to give a brief overview of that. We have visited every committee, I think, in the House, short of health and environment. Once we make it through this committee, 98 legislators will have had a crack at this bill. And with the exception of Representative Rukavina, who talked about a pen pack or a pocket protector, there's literally not been a comment, let alone a question, let alone anything but a unanimous vote for this Board of Accountancy technical bill. And very briefly, what it does is it brings into conformance Minnesota rules or statutes with the Uniform Accountancy Act. It provides for an accelerated CPA exam so that we can get folks out working as CPAs sooner. They still got to pass the same exam, but it just allows them to take it sooner once they're in their last semester of college. And it provides for an early effective date and expedited rulemaking for the board. The reason we're before the Finance Committee is because the revenue folks said that the finance folks said there was a $5,000 cost. We have addressed that with large firms picking up the tab. They are all in support of that, so that this is a revenue neutral proposal. And with that, Mr. Chair and members, I would appreciate your support. I do have Mr. Hyde here from who's here on behalf of the bill and works for Deloitte and Touche to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, any questions from members? Apparently none, Representative Atkins, and I assume then that folks are comfortable with the bill to the point of taking your suggestion for a consent calendar motion. Representative Anderson, maybe not.
Mr. Chair, our first question. I'm excited.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. I see in the bill it sets an initial permit fee of $100 and an annual fee of $68. Is that different than what is normal for the accountants, CPAs?
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Hyde.
My name is Robert Hyde. I'm on the State Board of Accountancy and chair of the Rules and Legislation Committee. Representative, the the initial permit fee is the same that currently exists. What was changed on the annual renewal fee was from $35 to $68. The purpose of that is to address the $5,000 cost that was associated with the mobility provision, in that individuals would not have to apply for a license under the mobility provision. That would cost the state approximately $5,000. That additional $30-some was just simply to compensate for that. It's only for those firms that have offices located in another state. So there's approximately 160 such firms out of the, you know, 500 or 600 firms. No firm that only has an office in Minnesota would have to pay that. So there's a slight increase in the, only in the $68 amount, from 35 to 68. Does that answer your question,
Representative? It's the extra $30 that's being picked up by these 160 firms, then? It's not being charged to the individual? So
correct. It is not being charged. Matter of fact, the bill really removes a charge from individuals and puts it on the firm. And in reality, the licensing fees of individuals are usually picked up by the firm anyway, so to put it back on the firms, it really didn't cost them anything either, because they're actually paying the individual fee anyway. So it's really more neutral. It's neutral to the state, it's neutral to the firms, and it just makes a more efficient licensing scheme.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, then, Representative Rukavina moves that Senate File 2402, the first official endorsement, be recommended to pass and placed on the consent calendar. Any further discussion? Hearing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And we'll now go to Representative Eakin. Oh, there we are. Would be Representative
Hilton. Mr. Chair, I would move the Energy Finance and Policy Division report for House File 3366, the first engrossment.
Okay, the motion is before us to adopt the report. Any discussion? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3366, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Eakin, if you'd like to walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the amendment was moved. Is that correct? We do have an amendment
moved
here.
It, yes.
If somebody could move the it's the A08-1574 amendment, I would appreciate that.
Okay, the
Chair, I'll make that motion.
Move the amendment. This would put the bill in the order that the author would like. Any discussion on the motion to adopt and amendment 1574? Seeing none, then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the amendment is just really clarifying language. We wanted to make it clear that this is a unique situation that we're trying to address through the Petro Fund. There is a fiscal note that's involved, and it is $1,219,000 that would be coming. Oh, okay. It's been revised down to $519,000 that would be coming out of the Petro Fund to cover the cost of replacing PVC pipe for heating oil systems. The reason that this is being done is that the PVC piping is known to certain glues that are used to hold the PVC piping together are known to dissolve with the heating oil, and as a result there have been some significant spills that have cost a lot of money to clean up. So they want to get out in front of this problem and replace the PVC piping before there's more spills, and the hope is actually that this is going to save money in the long run, because you're going to avoid these spills in the first place. And it's an incentive for homeowners to replace that PVC piping with metal piping. It doesn't pay the full cost of the replacement. It pays up to $250 or $250 for each of the replacements. It's estimated it's probably costing about $450. But it's an incentive. And again, it's hopefully going to save money in the long run. There's also an overall cap on how much can come from the petrol fund for this of $1,500,000. And because of that cap and because of the cap on how much individuals could receive, the PTA is also on board with this. So there's no opposition that I'm aware of to this bill. So thank you very much.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eakin, maybe you aren't the person to ask, but I'd like to have someone explain where the money comes to the petrol fund. Do you have someone that explain that?
Sure. And I don't know if Mr. Grossman would like to come forward and...
Welcome, and if you could identify yourself for the record. It looks like a good number of folks know you.
The other guy.
Oh, okay.
To Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Fisher. I'm the director of the Petro Fund program. And the Petro Fund is funded by a 2 cent per gallon fee that is paid by the first distributor in the state on petroleum products. And in general, it's whenever our fund balance drops below $4 million, the fee is turned on. So over the past 15 years or so, it's been on about 4 months out of the year.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've forgotten you. I didn't get your name. I'm sorry, but could you tell us how much it generates each year and the average?
Sure.
Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leader, my name is Joel Fisher with the Petro Fund. And in on average over the past 10 years, it generates approximately $27.2 million. That includes interest. Last fiscal year, 2007, it generated $28 million. And just to add to that, the Petro Fund over the year, our expenditures are right around $26 to $28 million a year.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Fisher, this is basically replacing PVC pipes for heating oil. Are you receiving any tax from heating oil or just from gasoline?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, we receive reimbursement applications for these type of releases right now, as well as petroleum releases. Basically, any type of tank, petroleum tank above ground or underground, that would have a release, we would get an application. We could reimburse costs for.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fisher, I mean, do you generate any revenue from the heating oil?
I'm sorry.
Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, our revenue would come from when the distributor delivers the fuel oil. The distributor is paying that fee, so I guess not specifically from the homeowner unless it's being passed through to the cost of the fuel is being passed through to the homeowner. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question or not.
Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, is there a taxing on the heating oil, or is it strictly you're getting it from gasoline?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, it is. It's on all petroleum products. So yes, there is a 2 cent per gallon. The 2% gallon fee, 2 cents per gallon fee does apply to heating oil.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is not so much a question for Mr. Fisher, but for Representative Eakin. I'm going to just the quick math says it's about 2,000. This fund will give the ability to do 2,000 replacements in a year. Is there an idea of how many PVC, how many homeowners have PVC piping in them, and at what point will it be done?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, we don't know for sure how many homeowners have PVC piping because this is being done by the homeowners themselves, and it's one of the reasons that this incentive is being offered is to get people who have put it in to come forward with this incentive. And until they do, I guess we won't have a firm handle on exactly how many are going to be replaced. And of course, if they don't spend all the money, that money would be available for other purposes, or actually it would, as you're saying, the amount would go down to reflect the lesser cost that's being brought into the Petro Fund. So there would be blinking off. So so it would self-correct. That money's not just going to be sitting there not being used.
Mr. Chair, and one of the, two things here is I'm almost grateful that you didn't, but after last night's lengthy session, I was kind of in a surly mood, and I was thinking maybe I'd have to have a conversation about the mechanical contractors that put this in, but you took some of it off the hook. The other point is that the Petro Fund, as I understand it, and, you know, I've only done a bit of history on it, was that it was supposed to replace leaking tanks at gas stations and, in some instances, homeowners. And it's been on for 20 years, which is great, and I think it's a wonderful program, everything I've learned over the last 10 years. But at some point, you know, it'd be really nice to be done with it. And I don't think you have the answer, but at some point you should be done charging people their 2% on petroleum products, whether it's heating oil or gasoline or kerosene or propane. No. But with that, I'll be done.
Okay. Any further discussion? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Eakin, I'm trying to get my hands on this. So you have a homeowner who has a fuel oil heating system, and they have put in PVC, and we've had those joints failing. So do they contact what department, and then they're reimbursed up to $250 per occasion, and is there someone that comes out and validates that, in fact, they're replacing the PVC and it's not walking off at $250?
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, and I may have to be corrected to make sure on this, but I believe the PCA would be the agency that would be involved in making sure that the work is being done. And I don't know if you could elaborate on that at all, but the PCA would be the agency with jurisdiction here.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so does that, if the PCA is the agency that does that, is there a permitting process that goes on where they have to go out to the site, indeed validate, and then write off the application so that they're reimbursed? And if that's the case, how much time is that cutting into the PCA's manpower issues, and how much are we actually spending on this program that, you know, we're helping them out, but I think we have a significant manpower investment in this as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, and we do have the fiscal notes of $519,000 that they estimate the cost to be. And again, there's a cap on the total amount that can be spent. The cap is $250 for individuals, and the PCA is on board with this. They support it, and so I think that's not a factor, an issue, at least with PCA at this point.
Any further discussion, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Eakin. I'm just wondering if there's any concern that this might actually encourage people not to comply because they might get rewarded with the public dollars. I know there's probably some code regulations that prohibit PVC use. I'm not sure what the penalty is for that, but I'm wondering if this could actually encourage people not to follow the code.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, actually I think it would be the opposite. This would get the word out that these PVC pipings do fail. Right now I think a lot of homeowners have put it in because they didn't understand that. This would be one way of getting that information out to them.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Eakin, you're repealing Section 115C subdivision 3J, and that's the money that's going to retail outfits and also a petroleum cargo tank. And is that been completed as far as the work in getting that done with all retailers and petrol trucks throughout the state of Minnesota? So we don't. Is that why we're getting rid of this?
Maybe that question could be better answered,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Fisher.
Yes, both of those programs have basically, they're completed. The work has been done, and we're not even generally receiving applications anymore. So the bulk plant upgrade, they actually had to submit applications, I believe, about a year ago. And for the other, for the vapor recovery, I think they received maybe 3 applications last year from, we were getting hundreds of them. So basically, the upgrades have all been done, and so there really isn't a need for those programs anymore.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Leader.
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to comment. That's the reason I brought it up. This is an automatic. Nobody knows it rolls in, and technically it's in about 4 months of the year, but if they draw it down too much, it could come in. It could be actually every month that you're paying a gasoline tax. And if all the problem we have passing gasoline tax, this is one that slips by that nobody knows about. I'm not complaining about it because it's done its job, but nevertheless, we have a real problem when you try to vote for a gasoline tax, and here's the one that goes automatically and you can't even control it.
Thank you for the information. Any further discussion? If seen, and then Representative Hilty removes his motion that House File 3366, the first engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Nelson, you'll be up next, and that's House File 3566, and Representative Rukavina, that will be one that came out of your division.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think it's appropriate.
Okay, Representative Rukavina moves the Higher Education and Workforce Development Division report for House File 3566, the first committee engrossment. The motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries. Representative Rukavina moves House File 3566, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Nelson, if you could walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll do the short version here. Basically, this is the Work Comp Advisory Commission bill that's coming forward. It's been worked on by the commission and agreed to by labor and the chamber, and the provisions here are what have been agreed to. There is a minor amendment that, again, both sides have agreed to that should have, you've got a fiscal note in your packet, and the Department of Human Services have told me that if we do this, it'll eliminate the fiscal impact to them. And on page 3, line 36, after the period, starting with if, delete that. Delete line 3.36 through 4.3, and that should take the fiscal impact out of the bill.
And Representative Nelson, just as you were speaking, members are receiving a copy of the amendment. I think everybody now has the amendment. Representative Rukavina, would you move the amendment?
Chair, I'll move the 8-2 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carries.
And Mr. Chair, what that does is part of the bill is there's a personal care attendant, and if you look on just above on 3.27, the part there was some ambiguity as far as who is responsible for the workers' compensation coverage for these personal care attendants. And the language that was put in here puts it that the fiscal intermediary who's being paid by the DHS to send these people out is the person that's responsible for the workers' compensation coverage, and that's what this is about. It's not going to fall back on the patient. It's not going to fall back on the injured worker. So that's what that part does. And there was some concern from the department that if what they weren't covered, that the fiscal intermediaries didn't have workers' compensation, that it would fall back on the department. The DHS has worked with Dolly, and they're going to share lists of those people to make sure that there's workers' compensation on these people. But otherwise, going through the bill, there's an increase in the maximum weekly compensation for injured workers of $100 a week. There's increases for QRCs, qualified rehabilitation consultants, increase the length of time that people could get temporary partial disability payments. They're going to get the savings out of the system by going to an electronic data system instead of a current forms-based system they have, and they feel that's going to get them the savings that they need. And that's basically the bill. It's the Workers' Comp Advisory Commission bill, and it's been agreed to by labor and industry, and both sides are on board with it.
Okay, any discussion on the bill? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Nelson, the repealers in here, can you just give you a brief summation of what those repealers do?
The one repealer is get my note here, but the one repealer has to do with obsolete language, had to do with federal tax language going, the 176.041, I believe that was from 1976, but I don't have it on my note here. The other one, 176.669, deals with obsolete language, talking about funding of workers' compensation that was going to take place in 1943, and so it's no longer necessary.
Thanks, Commander. Any further discussion, Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, you know, I've great respect for all the work you've done, and we've had a bit of a conversation, you know, about a part of the legislation that's a problem. And I'm sorry, it might be a function of being tired. I'm trying to remember on the part that says that complementary and alternative health care providers cannot be utilized anymore. Can you just remind me? I know you want to do something about that, or you think the commission may want to do something about that in the future, or can you just remind me where that is again?
Well, there's a sort of proposed Section 6 in the bill prohibits reimbursement of unlicensed, unregistered, complementary, and alternative health care providers unless they are working with or through a licensed or registered clinic. And so if they're working with a chiropractor or with a doctor, they will get compensated, but if they're working on their own, they won't. And there's been a little bit of an IRF on that, and we've been working with those people and working with the department and trying, you know, having conversations to try and deal with that. But the Commissioner of Labor and Industry feels that this is about quality of care and making sure that the money that's going for workers' compensation is going to people that's going to, they're going to get results out of it, and that's why they was put in there.
Yeah, I remember what their thoughts are on that. You just mentioned something now that might be helpful, which is it says unlicensed, but when you were referencing it right now, you said unlicensed and registered, and actually, if we could put the words unregistered, if it's the same, means the same to the group that looked at it, that would actually make a difference, because that does require standards of practice and all of that, and it's a little bit different. We have some professions that are, you know, do have a scope of practice that are registered, they're recognized by the Department of Health and so on, but they're not licensed. It's just another thing, and I'm just wondering if that was, when you referenced it right now, you said either or, do you know if that is what is meant? And if so, I'm wondering if we might, at some point in the process here, if we could check back with everyone, if we could clarify that, I guess.
I could check back. I'm also tired this morning, and I don't know if the department, some figure the department could answer that question, but we can, because we've looked into that, and there are discussions going on, and there's been discussions from myself going on with some of the people that testified to try and get to me and get something so we can try and work something out. But if it sits right here in the bill, I'm not at liberty to make that change without consulting with the department
right.
And consulting with the chamber and the AFL-CIO.
Mr. Chairman, if we could just have an agreement, I'm not asking for you to change the whole thing. That's another very long discussion. But I think the issue of what you referenced on licensed and unregistered, I think if that means the same to that group of people, that would be helpful, because it's a very big distinction. I'm not interested in going to the whole unregistered and licensed group and without a big discussion. But if that's a small clarification, that would be helpful to know. So maybe between here and the floor, if that's something we could talk about.
Okay, Representative Figger.
Thank you. You did very well. You did very well. Yeah. Representative Nelson, I'm not going to get into it with the new standards for the independent contractors that you and I had much discussion on last year when we established them. But I do have a question in regards to Section 11 on the Guarantee Act. When you say an employer Are political entities involved in that as well or not?
No, I don't believe so. I'm going to say that. But Section 11, I'll get my notes here. That's Minnesota, the guarantee. That's the Minnesota Insurance Guarantee Association. And right now, insurance companies pay into that. Right, there are some large employers that are over $25 million net worth or that have high deductible policies don't pay into that because they're exempted from that. And there's been a couple cases where they have not made payments, and so injured workers have gone uncompensated, and their bills haven't been paid. They haven't been paid their wages. And what this is going to do is allow that the MIGA to pick up those and making sure that the payments go to the doctors, the payments go to the injured worker, and then they have it. There's in the bill a way for them to go back at those companies and get payment and get penalties, so that the MIGA will be whole and then the injured worker will be whole, so that payments aren't delayed. And that's what this is about. There's been a couple cases in the last 2 years where this has happened, where large employers. The one case that was brought up by Assistant Commissioner Todd was that out of state employer that did this, and the injured worker, they had to fight it because there was no one to pick up the bill while they were fighting it. So this is going to make sure the injured worker and the doctors get paid for the services, but there's also provision in there so they can go back with penalties attached to it and get payment back for that, putting out that money.
Thank you. In regards to the political entities, whether they're involved or not, when you talk about the $25 million, you've got to say, for example, a city will have holdings of that automatically. Some of the cities will own a hospital or a power plant or whatever. It's going to put them up over the threshold. So it does create a problem in the qualifications. Now, Representative Piemar is not a member of this committee. I know him and I have had some discussions on insurance companies and the amounts that they're required to have to keep them from going into insolvency. And there's some, he had a bill on the floor a couple of years ago. I know him and I had extensive discussion on. But if you do, I would, if you can find more information sometime, whether or not political entities like a city would qualify here, I'd appreciate that.
I wrote myself a note tonight.
Right, thank you.
Here, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to go back to the point that Representative Clark was making and remind the author and Representative Clark that this particular bill in itself, the workers' comp bill, is such a highly negotiated bill that hopefully rather than going to the floor, any kind of thing that we do with this issue is brought before that particular committee, the Workers' Comp Board, and comes back next year, because we got to fix it, I understand, and I have no doubts for that. But this is such a highly negotiated bill, I hate to open anything up in it.
Point well taken. Any further discussion? Well, seeing none then, Representative Rukavina renews his motion that House File 3566, the First Committee engrossment, be recommended to staff as amended and placed on the General Register. So any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. The next bill is Representative Solberg, and he's in a conference committee right now, so I told him we would just hold it and take it up later on the agenda, or move it to a later point on the agenda. So now we go to House File 3343, Representative Junkie and Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I move the Energy, Finance, and Policy Division report for House File 3343, the First Committee Engrossment.
Motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Junkie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a basically a wind aggregation bill. About a year ago, out at the University of Minnesota Morris, we became aware that when people order windmills in small quantities, U of M Morris wanted at that time to order one to add to their experiment station out there. They put out RFPs, and they came back with no takers on the RFP, no bidders. So when they contacted them, the bidders said, well, life is good with windmills, basically, and we're not accepting orders for less than 10. And so the Commerce Department was out there with me that day, and we started doing some brainstorming. We thought, well, when we have municipal utilities or colleges or schools that want to buy one or two windmills and can't do it, the Commerce Department essentially would become an aggregator. They would collect the orders from people or the interest from people that need the windmills, and when they get to a set amount, they could then place the order, guarantee the sale. It doesn't cost us any money, but at least we can put those orders in for those one- and two-unit orders if we run into that problem in the future. So this bill simply allows that. There's been no opposition to it, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate your support.
Okay, any discussion on the Junkie motion? Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Junkie, do you... so none of this is a subsidized program, this is just a coordination program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Severson, that is correct. The Commerce Department will coordinate and collect names of people and orders and basically place the order if we need to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, any further discussion? Representative Heidi Gerken.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Junkie. I'm very familiar with the problem that we have out there in Polk County, especially. We've got small entities that are trying to buy these, as you had mentioned. The problem is that Florida Power and Light has come into a lot of the areas, and they have established contracts, and some of these small companies will call, or small groups want to put these towers up, and be told that they're in a waiting list because Florida Power and Light has pretty much got all the, you know, they're the first question they ask you guys from Florida Power and Light, and not, well, you're going to have to wait a couple of years. But with that said, Representative Hilty is also a member of this committee, and Representative Aaron Peterson and I had an amendment last night that we're going to offer the floor, and I think Representative Hilty, we're going to work with a little bit with wind rights as well. Some of these small guys have got the issue with that, but thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I would make the motion and renew it at the same time that House File 3343, first reading, Grossman, be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
And any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried.
Thank you, members.
Representative Hilty, House File 3401. And as Representative Hilty is going forward, Representative Hilty moves the Energy Finance and Policy Division report for House File 3401, the first committee engrossment. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hilty, if you'd care to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I believe that we have the Senate file in our possession. I would move Senate file 2706, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, Representative Hilty.
And, Mr. Chair, I would... also move to delete the Senate language and amend the language from House File 3401, the First Committee Engrossment, into Senate File 2706.
Okay, so that then is an amendment to the first motion. So any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. So we now have the Senate file before us as amended with the House language. That's correct, Representative Hilty?
That would be correct, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty?
Mr. Chair and members, House File 3401, or Senate File 2706, is a... bill which would provide for the development of sustainable building guidelines. It reflected an effort in Minnesota to join what is currently a national effort among our architects and engineers to develop building codes that would exceed current energy saving guidelines. The national movement is often referred to as Architecture 2030, the goal being by 2030 to have reduced the amount of energy consumed in architectural structures of every kind, residential, commercial, and industrial, by at least 50%. What this bill provides for is just the initial steps of that process in Minnesota would require the commissioner of the Department of Commerce to contract with the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota to develop those standards. It does not at this point put any thing into law regarding the standards, that merely provides for the development of those standards over the next few years.
It's a Rep. Tim Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, did you ever think to come to Chairman Rukavina's committee, which deals with the Department of Labor and Industry and all the codes, code promulgation and code enforcement? Because it's a two-part question here. You're putting engineers and architects in charge of the codes, and you know they created a lot of concerns over the last several years, and we spent a tremendous amount of time last session bringing people who had practical experience in this to the table, and now you just took them away from the table.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, this is an initial step in the process. What this process would do is create a proposal that then would need to be considered. It's not creating codes, it's creating a proposal for codes. So the next step of the process certainly would be what, you know, to meet your concern, but we don't have any proposal at this point to be considered.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I'm not going to meddle with your bill, but I will tell you that I would strongly urge you to consider putting people who are actually going to work with this, you know, in the field, into even the earlier parts of this proposal. And I will tell you in this particular fashion, I sat through a fairly lengthy class on LEED certification with a number of people that were, you know, the people who actually put it in. And we got through the first 100 pages of the process, and there were so many holes and loopholes and ways through that and around that that it was, you know, I came away with kind of a sour feeling and LEED certification, and so I went to some of the other certifications and looked at them. I'm not God's gift to the pipe fitting industry, but I could certainly poke holes in it. You might get something that you would, less holes could be poked in it when it's done, which is kind of what we really want to do. We're not looking for perfection, just something as close as we can get it.
Well, Chair Representative Mahoney, your point is well taken, and I believe that actually, it's the kinds of experiences in the past that, which you refer to have given rise to this initiative. I think it's well recognized that if you don't have a very deliberative process in working out these proposed standards, that you can run into the kinds of problems that we've seen. And hopefully this process would have learned that lesson well, and certainly the intention to evolve the proposed standards that would have addressed all of those issues.
Any further discussion, Representative Anderson?
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, President Hilliard, talking here about the bill exceeding the code by at least 30%, the state code for sustainable buildings. Is that in dollars and cents going to be feasible to meet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think the experience has been that in terms of dollars and cents, Mr. Chair, when you mentioned before we began the meeting that we were a couple members short of a quorum, I reflected that's kind of how I'm feeling myself this morning.
It's probably everyone, Representative.
Representative Anderson, I think the experience has been that when green principles are incorporated into building projects, that especially in the long term, they are enormous energy savers. It has been observed by a number of experts in various fields that probably the best possibility that we have for energy saving in our economy is with building design. It's been estimated that as much as 50% of the energy that goes into buildings currently is wasted. So, yeah, I think this is a process that, if it's completed as anticipated, would result in enormous savings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, so this applies to all buildings, I take it. Is it going to be from the time that the bill is enacted forward, or is it going to include retrofitting all the state buildings in the state of Minnesota, and do you have a cost to that?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the bill does not require anything. It initiates a process for evolving the standards that then would have to be approved and implemented. The standards that are evolved would be for, as I said earlier, residential, commercial, and industrial buildings, and also for renovation, but it's not putting any requirements into law. It's simply initiating the process of evolving those standards.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
Hilty, setting the process means that there's a beginning that is going to cost so much and so forth and so on, and I know that the bill itself may not have a cost to it as it sits now, but
well,
the impact of this is going to have a major cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the bill does have a cost. It provides for use of some of the funding for from the Conservation Improvement Program that the utilities are responsible for currently to go into this. The anticipated result of that would, since it would apply to the utilities' energy savings goal of 1.5% per year,
it would ultimately be greatly to their benefit. But as I said, this is simply evolving a set of standards that then would be offered to the legislature for approval, and we could assess them or not. If at that point the standards that were evolved were deemed to be too expensive to be implemented, I guess that would be the conclusion, but that's certainly not the expectation. The expectation is quite different than that.
Oh, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, these probably are not new standards. They've been used. You probably got these from some other state or other area, or they are our own standards. And have they been sort of mean tested to see what are given some kind of a cost? You said cost savings, but the cost.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. The standards do not exist at this point. As I mentioned, there is a national effort, generally referred to as Architecture 2030, in which architects, engineers, designers across the country are engaged in this work. I presume that there would be pretty much a nationwide exchange of information and ideas, but the reason that we need to do this specifically for Minnesota is that obviously we have different building design requirements in Minnesota than, say, a group working on sensible standards for Arizona would have. So this is just beginning to ask the questions. It's not imposing any requirements on anyone. It's not incurring any cost other than the cost of running the program, which comes from the Conservation Improvement Program.
So, Mr. Chair, it's a work in progress.
Chair, that's correct.
Okay, Representative Peterson. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to alleviate some fears here, one of the parts of the bill that I really thought was a smart part on Representative Hilty's and the other author's part was on page 1, line 19 through 123. It really kind of limits this to start with to major renovations, not less than 10,000 square feet with mechanical ventilation and cooling systems. So it's really setting slopes. I mean, it's not, they're not jumping in with both feet. They're kind of testing the water with the backside of their hands. So this is not a bad way to go. Of course, he will take in the practical experience, I'm sure.
Representative Peason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, just to Representative Mahoney's point, so we have sustainable building guidelines now that are in place, and then this is developed to develop new ones for other buildings. Is that right? And then, but my real question is, this on line 3.30 to 3.32, can you just explain what that, what cost-effective measurement we're measuring here? Is that cost-effective from a conservation point of view or cost-effective from a building point of view?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I believe that that what we're talking about is energy efficiency. We're talking about the performance standards for the building. The intention is to create designs and standards for new buildings and for renovations that would be as energy efficient as possible. We're not talking about conservation beyond that. I mean, we're not talking about efficiency or savings in any other term.
there would be savings in other terms, but that's not what's intended.
Okay, any further discussion on Representative Pepin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hilty, I'm just kind of trying to get a handle on the scope of this. Does this apply to private or any local government buildings that have a partial a state assistance?
That help?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, the standards that would be evolved would eventually, hopefully, be standards that would apply to new construction in residences, commercial, and industrial buildings.
So is that outlined somewhere? Okay. Is that outlined in here in the text of the bill?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Actually, in subdivision one.
Okay, and then I just have one other question.
Just say it's...
I'm just trying to understand the actual reduction, and just from a technical perspective, could you describe a little bit, and maybe Representative Peace and hit on a little bit, I'm trying to understand building efficiencies as they are now, and so how this is going to reduce it. I need to understand what the efficiencies are, how they're measured, that type of thing now.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, effective, the main problem that we have encountered with building design and efficiency is in the way it consumes energy. Consumes energy for lighting and for heating and cooling. There are a lot of possibilities for design that would really lower those energy usages. There are a lot of examples of that, including Great River Energy's new headquarters in Maple Grove, which is the first will be the first platinum certified LEED building in the state, in which every aspect of the design of that building was with energy savings in mind, to maximize the use of natural heating and cooling, natural lighting, etc. That's where the savings are in building design.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're getting closer to where I'm going. I'm trying to figure out exactly how it's measured. Is this allowable energy per square foot? I'm trying to figure out the actual measure to get these percent. I'm trying to figure out how this is feasible. And for this to be feasible, you have to be able to measure something now versus measure what your goal is. I'm trying to understand how exactly the efficiency is measured. And I think it's probably energy per square foot, but I'm just trying to sort of get a handle on how the measurement is done. Maybe it's a technical staff question or a utilities question. I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, one way that it's measurable is just, I think this is kind of a standard calculation, is carbon emissions per square foot, which can be calculated in terms of energy use.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I applaud you, Mr. Hilty, for trying to look at cost effectiveness, cost efficiency. My concern is that the codes that we have in place in the past have supposedly been dealt with to come up with cost effectiveness, cost efficiency. And I know people in my area who have, because of the state standard codes for building home residential, have made them to the standards, to the specs of the state, and we've found out we've had mold problems. And that, you remember those a couple years ago, the big mold problem that we have because of the standards set by the state. I'm concerned also when you talk in here about efficiency and effectiveness that we end up with a similar problem going forward in these buildings, whether it's in commercial or industry or especially residential, that we end up putting standards in place that end up impacting in such a way in a negative environment the health of our citizens in our counties and in our areas that we live in. So I think this is a caution. Great words to put in statute, but it's also something that we should be concerned about when we ask the commissioner to establish these standards, that we have real people on the ground and people out there that I know my father's a contractor, former carpenter, and he saw some of the standards that we were putting in the statute back in the 80s, and he thought they were ridiculous, but he's only one person in the industry. And my concern is, especially because of the many people that have contacted me in regards to, quote, energy efficient, energy effectiveness, so forth and so on, that we don't end up impacting the health care of our citizens. So I'll just give you that as a foregone warning, I guess, to as we go forward with this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, you know, I know I'm probably not the brightest person at this table. In fact, I might be the dumbest person at this table. So, you know, well, I know my roommate always claims to be dumber than me, but anyway, you know, it's great, all of these studies and that, but I'm come from an area where we just like to do it, you know. So, Representative Hilty, the $500,000 a year that you're appropriating to the Center for Sustainable Building Research, where is that coming from every year?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth Sabina is coming from the Conservation Improvement.
From the TIP program?
Yes.
And every year, they're going to get this money for how many years? For till 2030, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ruth Sabina, if you look in Section 2 of the bill,
forever,
it would be an annual appropriation, but if you go to subdivision 9 in Section 3 on page 3, the plan needs to be submitted to the legislature by July 1st, 2009.
So you anticipate,
the Rookman.
Mr. Chair, just a couple years of appropriation then, or 2 years?
That would be the anticipation.
Okay. Because I thought you could buy a lot of, you know, light bulbs and new windows that would make it a lot more efficient and get let people have them and accomplish.
Well, this would be an ongoing, this could be an ongoing process, Representative Rukavina. I don't mean to say that I think the whole thing would be completed by 2009.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering, Representative Hilty, too, like, you know, in your language on page 3, on 3.29 and 3.30, you know how I feel about imports and everything else, so, you know, by the time you reach your 90% goal in 2025, when we'll probably be importing everything from basement bricks to windows from China, are we going to take into account the transportation costs and everything else to create, and how much energy we spent moving everything around to in part of the reaching the 80% or 90%? Because, you know, I mean, I built my house from the ground up. I cut the trees down. I cut them on a sawmill in my backyard. I built the house. I figure I got a 90% efficient house right now, saving all those costs, you know, because I'm the original. I mean, I didn't have a I had a Ringer washing machine until 7 years ago, and Representative Thomasoni then got everybody to pitch in and buy me an automatic washing machine. It makes me sick. It makes me sick watching that thing recycle and use all that water because, but, you know, I'm just a dummy, as I said. So, you know, when I do those types of things, Representative Hilty, aren't I a lot more energy efficient than, you know, have I met those goals already? Because, you know, I'm trying to think how you can be 90%.
Representative Rukavina, I would hate to speculate about the size of your carbon footprint.
and I'm burning wood as we speak. So, well, Mr. Chair, I don't know. I mean, to me,
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, you know, the questions that you're asking here and the questions from Representative Mahoney and Representative Anderson are certainly appropriate. They have to keep in mind that the intention here is to bring together people that understand these issues, understand building design, to try to learn from the lessons of the past, the mistakes that have been made in the past, and to implement current understanding, current research, to just put forward standards that we would still have to approve. That,
oh, Mr. Chair, I
hopefully would be capable of demonstrating energy efficiencies and savings in building design.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to support Representative Hilty because I trust his judgment and I know his heart's in the right place and he's brighter than I am, but I still think I do have some legitimate questions as to whether or not I could have a little more practical use of that SIP money, but I just wanted to, you know, raise some issues at home and let the committee know how environmentally sound my policies
are. We have, let's see, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. I'm on page 3, line 26, and I'll just read it. The performance standard must reflect the reductions in carbon dioxide emissions per square foot resulting from actions taken by utilities to comply with the renewable energy standards in section 216B.1691. Now, I just looked it up, and that's all utilities. That is, has nothing to do with residential or commercial or commercial industrial properties other than utility companies. Because, and Mr. Chair, like I say, 216B, 1691 is, I mean, it's all utilities.
I believe, Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, that's the section of statute refers to the Conservation Improvement Program.
The renewable energy objective. And as I said, it looks like it's all utilities. So, I mean, I'm sure we'll have a conversation after this, because I'm going to pull your bill out and to wherever you want to send it, because like my friend Representative Rukavina, I respect and trust you, but certainly we're going to have a conversation about it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I misspoke in the section that's in a different part of the bill. The section you're referring to is renewable energy standards. So that's a requirement that's already in law that the utilities are required to meet. That's 25x25 standard.
Correct.
So, what this simply is saying that the standards must reflect the reduction that is required by those standards. In other words, what the intention here is to help them meet those standards.
Mr. Chair.
Come on.
But not to belabor the point, the question I have is that, are they for residential or utility? And I, if I read it, and granted I could be wrong, it looks like it's only focusing in on utility companies. It's not focusing in on Rukavina's energy efficient, carbon footprint neutral house.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the standards ultimately would be evolved so that they would apply to your house. But the intention is to reduce our energy consumption. That is the requirement. We have reduction requirements. Not only the renewable energy standard simply applies to where the energy comes from renewable energy sources, but conservation improvement program and the new energy efficiency requirements that are on utilities require them to actually reduce their to increase their energy efficiency and reduce their energy sales by 1.5% per year. So what we hope to accomplish here is to evolve standards that would make it possible for those goals to be met.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Hilton. If this is going to affect residential standards, on page 3, line 29, there's a 60% reduction by 2010, a 70% reduction by 2015. I'm very fortunate. I have just put a substantial addition onto my home. If I had done that 2 years later, would I have had to meet a 60% reduction in the energy usage of that particular home? Because I can't meet that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, once again, what we're talking about here is helping to evolve standards that would make it possible to achieve these goals in new construction. If this group can put their heads together and come up with ways to do this and present it to the Department of Administration and the Department of Commerce and to the legislature and convince all of us that this is feasible, then the legislature could put those standards into the building code. But all this bill is asking for is for hopefully some of the best brains that we have in architecture and engineering in the state come together and figure out if and how to meet, if it's possible and how to meet these goals.
Again, I'll take that your word, but I'm going to ask between here and wherever this bill gets to the floor, with what you're proposing here, that you include the Department of Labor and Industries Code Division into this group of best brains and best thoughts. I am looking at this, and there is a chill going down my back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to get clarification on Representative Mahoney's first question, that's 3.24 to 3.26 language. The way I read that is that we're going to count the savings shifting from coal or carbon-based stuff to renewable stuff, that will, to the extent we move in that direction and start reducing emissions that way, that will count against the reductions we're trying to meet in the 60% reductions, for instance. So that'll be one piece of the reduction. That's kind of the way I'm reading that language. And I think that so we'll actually make progress toward it without doing anything to buildings itself just because we're moving to renewable energy. Or non-carbon emitting energy, I guess maybe is a better...
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen is essentially correct, but what these are... We're simply describing the goals of what will be a working group. If you refer to the top of page 3, lines 3.3 through 3.10, clear down to 3.18, the proposal here is to contract with the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota to coordinate the development and implementation of energy efficiency performance standards, strategic planning, etc., etc. The Commissioner and the Center shall, in consultation with utilities and experts in building design and technology, develop a sustainable building 2030 implementation plan that at the minimum must address the following issues: training architects to incorporate the performance standards in building design, incorporating the performance standards in utility conservation improvement program, and developing procedures for ongoing monitoring energy use in buildings that have adopted the performance standards. There's nothing to say that standards that developed would ever end up in building codes.
That's fine. Representative Tiger, I thought that was awesome. Representative Hilty then renews his motion that Senate File 2706, the second engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any further discussion? Seeing none then, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr. Chair, turn the chair over
Madam Chair, I would move the Energy Finance and Policy Division report for House File 3661, the first committee in growth. And Madam Chair, I would further move House File 3661, the first committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass and place on the general register.
Thank you, Representative Hilty. All in favor of adopting the division report for House File 3661, first committee in Grossman? Aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry, I didn't see that there was a question. Representative Peppin. Madam Chair, excuse me, was the motion to put this on the, what was the calendar, the consent calendar or the general register?
Yeah.
Adopt the division report.
Just the division report.
Right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, division report is passed. Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair and members, what House File 3661 does in the first two sections is basically ask for a report on progress on the progress that is being made by the Commissioner of Commerce and the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency, who are responsible for making a plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the state. This is part of the legislation that was passed last year, and really all that sections 1 and 2 do is provide that those commissioners who have that responsibility make progress reports to the legislature. I think the thing that has attracted some attention to this bill is not that, which is how the bill started out, but along the way we picked up a bill that initially was Representative Atkins' bill regarding what are known as high global warming potential greenhouse gases, and that would be from Section 6 to the end of the bill. What this section of the bill does is again provide for reporting requirements for leakage of these greenhouse gases that are used in as a refrigerant, and particularly in automobile air conditioning units. Their greenhouse gas potential is enormously greater than that of carbon dioxide or the more common greenhouse gases. And currently we don't really have any data on how much of these in the normal processes are escaping into the atmosphere. So we don't have adequate data, and what the bill does basically is require reporting of those, and it also does prohibit the sale of small canisters that are sometimes used by people to do their own maintenance on air conditioning units, which is very difficult for anyone other than a trained mechanic in proper conditions to do. There's a great leakage potential for that, and the bill does prohibit that that sale or phase out. There is a fiscal note to the bill members, but this is it does not have an impact to the general fund.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Helpy. Are you finished?
And stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Representative Rucavina.
I was just going to ask the reasoning behind the language on page 4, Representative Hilty, on the not being able to, but no, you did touch on it before I raised my hand, but, I mean, so a person, in order to get their air conditioner and their car recharged, would have to go to a dealer and not be able to, a handyman to be able to, or a handy woman to be able to do it themselves. Is that...
Representative Hilty.
Is that what's going on here?
Madam Chair, Representative Rucavina, that's correct. My understanding of that situation is that with the way these systems are constructed the recent automotive designs, it's very difficult, it's bordering on impossible for someone that does not have the proper equipment and there is lubricating processes involved that I don't understand, but my understanding is that it's very difficult for someone to do this kind of servicing on their own without basically allowing a lot of this stuff to escape.
Do you know, Madam Chair,
do
you know what is the cost? Does anybody know to recharge your air conditioner in your car? You got to go to a dealer?
Representative Hilke.
I don't know that, Madam Chair, Representative Ruth Cavina. I think the last time I did it, it cost about $50.
Okay, and then finally, okay, Madam Chair, members, is there a cost to the AG's office on the website for the vehicle leakage and language and everything? Or are they just absorbing that and did they tell you they were?
Representative Hilton.
I don't have a copy of the fiscal note, but I am...
That doesn't mention the AG's office at all, so I was just wondering.
I'm sorry, I do have a copy of the fiscal note. I don't understand what involvement the Representative Bruce Cavina would be referring to with the AG's office.
Well, you require the Office of the Attorney General to have post on their website the leakage rate disclosed by the manufacturers, and then the following statement's got to be on there. So there must be, you know, some cost to the AG's office to... in dealing and gathering all that information that you're requiring the car manufacturers submit to them and then posting it. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Ruth Cavina, the cost of doing that would fall on the Pollution Control Agency. They would simply be providing the, if you read that line, it says the agency and the Office of Attorney General. So the agency collects the information and would simply provide that to the Attorney General's office, and I can't imagine that there would be any significant cost in their taking something that's just handed to them and posting it on their website.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hilty, I'm a little bit familiar with some of this, in that, you know, when we used to have the, I think it was RU5 refrigerant that was in the cars, all of a sudden the mandate came out and said you can no longer do that, you have to go to an R12, I think it was. And that was because of the ozone. I'm trying to think, in 1980s, 1970s was the Ice Age scare, 1990s was the ozone scare, and now we've got the greenhouse global warming scare going on here. And I'm wondering if you have any background information on the state of the ozone since we implemented that law.
Representative Helpy.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. No, I don't. And I think I captured drift here, and all I can say is I hope that, you know, as we touched on in the discussion of the last bill, I hope that we're starting to learn something. You know, I hope that we are perhaps moving in a direction that we don't keep making the same kinds of mistakes over and over. But in fact, what is reflected in this bill and is clear is that this is these substances, as they exist, clearly have an enormous potential, and we don't really understand well enough where they're going. We have kind of the same problem that we had back when we first discovered that there was a problem that nobody anticipated I'm blanking on the
ozone.
No, not in Arizona, but with the chlorofluorides that were causing the problem that everybody thought was just inert. So I think what this portion of the bill requires, which I think is well advised and prudent, is simply that we start keeping track of what's going on here. And how much of this is leaking, how much potential there is for a problem. And we know that there is a problem with those small containers that it's simply not prudent to continue to use those.
Yeah.
I
understand where you're going with this, and I applaud you for the effort here. My concerns are that, you know, we're trying to bash a tack with a hammer or with a sledgehammer here. I think part of this process is how much impact is there going to be, and I think the classic example was the ozone scare. You know, when we went to the different materials, and then we find out that, in fact, the ozone is replacing itself through different processes of which we have no control over. Nor does this have a huge impact on how that ozone layer is replenished. And so the same thing, I mean, if you're talking about global warming here, you're talking about carbon footprints and a predetermined notion that increase in carbon is going to create global warming is not a fact science. If you talk about the Pacific vent that was discovered in 2001 by NASA, that has a huge effect on carbon buildup, or carbon dioxide buildup. And as you know, just as a matter of issue, 28 to 30 degrees of temperature up in the atmosphere vents out into space. So that there's a whole myriad of issues that we're trying to really micromanage this thing and say, you know what, we can have an impact here, and I don't believe we can. But my bigger concern here is that we're putting onto our consumers this mindset that they're going to be able to transform something they have no control over. And so I think with this whole process here, although noteworthy because it makes us do a feel-good, you know, like we're doing something, my concern is that we have no real control over this process. Now, if your idea here is that we're going to do a study so we can really figure out that we can't do anything, then I'm kind of for that. So maybe we could put this thing to rest. But if the idea is that we're going to find some processes here that we can implement, that we do some feel-good maneuvers that are going to cost our taxpayers more and more dollars and more inconvenience, and do a cap and trade that's going to drive the cost of energy out the door so that our businesses can't do business any longer, then I got some real reservations. And I'm sure we'll have a great discussion on the House floor on this process, and I look forward to it, but at this point, I'm finding it very difficult to support a lot of the stuff that's coming through with the whole term global warming, and that we're going to actually be able to have an effect on what this does. So thank you for your indulgence, Madam Chair, and Representative Hilty, and I look forward to the discussion.
Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, Representative Hilty, I have an awful lot of backyard mechanics in my district, and you want me to tell them that they can't put more refrigerant, they can't screw on a shaver valve, read a gauge, high side, low side, open up a valve, read the gauge, close the gauge, take the shaver valves off?
Representative Hilty?
That's exactly what you're doing here, Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, when I was a kid, most of the backyard mechanics that I knew did things like change their own oil. And you know what they did with the oil when they extracted it from their vehicle to use the oil? Mostly since I lived out in the country, they just dumped it on their driveway to hold the dust down. And I suppose that keeping them from doing that had a significant impact on them. Significant economic impact when they had to go to a service station to have the oil change, or at least had to quit dumping it on the ground and find some way to dispose of it in a sensible manner. And I don't think anybody's saying that some of the things that we need to do don't have any costs involved. And yeah, this probably does for a handful of people that actually attempt to do this have some cost. But my understanding, at least, is that with modern vehicles, this is a sufficiently complex process that it's almost impossible for those guys to do it right. Partly, I believe, at least I am told, because the valve connection involves some lubrication process that probably no one that's trying to do this in their backyard is capable of doing properly. Same thing, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, I used to do a lot of mechanical stuff on tractors and our old Ford pickup truck. I didn't have a computer that frustrated everything that we tried to do. But we're talking about different systems than existed then. They're complex, and I don't think that any of them just are amenable to somebody puttering around with them. If people,
Madam Chair,
I just don't think that that's a
Representative Hilty. I want you to go and tell my partner in life that she's incompetent in putting the air conditioning valve because that's what she did last summer. And Representative Hilty, I
want you to raise your temperature.
Representative Hilty, you don't vent refrigerant. You add refrigerant to an air conditioning system. Unless you're cutting the whole system out and rebuilding it. And then I would say, yes, you're correct. You probably need a mechanic that's trained in it. I think that whole section there is very, very problematic. Thank you for indulging me.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. To the cost of this, can someone explain to me what the environmental fund is that's paying for this? The agency's absorbing it in the environmental fund. You know, we just went through a whole session, Representative Genius, on the floor yesterday because apparently PCA doesn't have enough fees to do all this, and now we've got to put reports together, and everyone's got to pay their fair share. Yet when it comes to posting rates of leakage of air conditioners on a website, they're able to absorb it in the agency in their environmental fund, 1.5 FTEs worth. I mean, I'm finding that kind of amazing, and I'm just wondering what that environmental fund is, and maybe we can use it for some of the other things they do to absorb costs.
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, I don't have the answer to that. As I mentioned earlier, this section of the bill is actually not my bill. It was Representative Atkins' bill initially, and that's one of the things that I have not looked into.
Madam Chair, maybe PCA up here in the room could come up and tell me what the environmental fund is that they're absorbing this into, and how much money's in that fund, and how much will be there in the future, and how do we collect the money in that fund? Are they here? They're not here? Maybe
to that point.
Virginius, can you help me?
Representative Virginius, to that point.
To that point. I could perhaps help you out. The environmental fund.
Can you use your mic?
There's two funds that PCA has, their own environmental fund and a remediation fund, and they kind of transfer money back and forth. I have questions about that. But the environmental fund is mainly the score money, you know, the tax on your garbage, that's what's in the environmental fund. There is some money in your environmental fund from that automobile transfer thing, but we have used that funding stream in the bonding bill as a funding stream to pay for revenue bonds to pay for landfill cleanup because we're so out of money. So there's also some hazardous waste fee in there, and there's one other fee. Oh, the water fee, but those are very low. So it's mainly now, I would say, the waste fee. We didn't get enough sleep last night, so I'm not as sharp as I could be today.
Well, Madam Chair, and
thank you, Representative Johnson.
I guess before this gets to the floor, I'd like PCA to come tell me and show me that this is an appropriate use for that money, number one, if it's being collected for garbage or whatever it's being collected.
That is what it is.
You know,
thank you, Representative.
Now we're using it to chart a coolant going up in the air. I don't know. I'd like to see some statutory language on the use of those dollars, and then I'd like them to explain how much money they're going to have in that in the future. So maybe our mining friends or ethanol friends or other developing industries can tap into that for their use, too. So that's one question, and I'd like that answered. I'm surprised PCA isn't here since we're a finance committee and it's a finance question in their division, but that's beside the point. The mobile air conditioning, Section 6, Representative Hilty, I'm just curious, following up again on what Representative Mahoney said, no person may buy or sell a refrigerant in less than 15 pounds. Are we the only state that's doing that, or is this a national thing, or can I go out to eBay tomorrow and buy it anyway? I'm questioning that section, like Representative Mahoney, what kind of effect that is having, or are those containers smaller than that not available anywhere in this country?
Representative Hilty.
Madam Chair, Representative Junkie, I don't know about anywhere in the country. I'm told that Wisconsin has a similar measure that's already in effect. I presume there are other states that do as well.
And Representative,
thank you, Representative Hilty.
Again, I think, I don't know that that's going to be effective or not. I guess I'm just curious, Representative Hilty, and in all due respect, where did all this come from? I mean, we're reading the language here. You got to post vehicle air conditioning systems can leak refrigerants that contribute to global warming. Some leak more than others. You can use the information, et cetera, et cetera. Why didn't you say some leak less than others? I mean, where did this language come from? Who provided this? I don't think it's something you dreamed up, because I know that legislation usually comes from somewhere. So this whole thing, where did it come from? Where did it initiate?
Representative Hilty.
Well, Representative Junkie, as I said, this was not my bill initially. It was Representative Atkins' bill.
Representative Atkins.
I don't know the history of how this came to him in the first place. I think there may be someone here that can shed some light on that if you want to have some testimony.
Well, I don't need it now, but again,
it's
one of those questions, Madam Chair. At the end of the day, seriously, how many in here have bought a car in the last year or two or five or ten? How many of you went to the AG site or the PCA site before you bought it to check and see how much the air conditioner leaked? I mean, show of hands? I mean, it was like, it's not something that's done yet. We're spending one and a half full-time equivalents to collect and post this data, and I'm not sure who's using it. I mean, it's one thing to have the data as we make policy decisions on overall amounts of global warming, and then we decide on what type of vehicle fleets, which is what we're talking about with the CARB and other things. But to spend an entire bill and at least two departments, the AG and the PCA, Commerce too, Commerce, PCA, and AG, putting this together. And again, you get down to the question of why. And I know it's not your bill originally. I wish Atkins wouldn't have run away, because it was his first time here, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair. We could have grilled him on this, and he would have got a taste of this committee. But so again, I just think this whole bill is this whole bill just has it's just loaded with questions, and I'm just not I'm not getting I don't think good answers for good policy in this particular PIPA legislation. I'll leave it at that. But I just don't see this moving rapidly through the process at this point.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hilty, I have a couple different questions. Some are just technical, and some are a little more detailed. But for a technical question, this is, again, for me, if you could just educate me on this, I'd appreciate it. The mobile air conditioner refrigerant restriction on the last page, no person may sell or buy a refrigerant designed to be used in a mobile air conditioner in a container holding less than 15 pounds of refrigerant. I'm not really sure what that means, and I noticed the page before it talked about a manufacturer selling or offering for sale a new motor vehicle in the state containing a mobile air conditioner that uses the high GWP greenhouse gas. And I guess I'm not sure, do most vehicles use the high GWP? And then if you could answer that question, and then the 15 pounds of refrigerant, if you could put that into context, what's that all about? I don't understand what that section's about. And do most mobile air conditioners use less than 15? If you could just kind of help me understand this, it's just a little confusing for me.
Madam Chair, Representative Pepin, I'm not sure how much light I can shed on that. It's my understanding that yes, most, if not all, modern vehicles do use basically the same refrigerant. And Section 6, to which you refer, is referring to a small canister that's available in the auto parts store that can be used in it.
What's the rationale? It releases more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It releases more. It leaks more. What is exactly the rationale for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, yes, my understanding of the rationale of that is that the connection that you make between the canister and the system, while it may seem somewhat straightforward, involves seals and lubricants that make the connection, if it's not done by someone that's trained in doing this, make it at least have a potential for significant leakage of the refrigerant.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. Thank you for indulging me in that. That helps me understand a little bit. I guess my next question is, I'm looking at a copy of Senate File 3337, the companion, and it's quite a bit different. The Senate file has an additional section that would be inserted after line 2.14 titled Reduction Principles, and it's got seven different principles, and the first one is reduction must be attained. And then the rest of the bill relating to the greenhouse gas, I believe, is not on there. I don't have the second page. So I'm just wondering, since the bill that you're carrying, it doesn't have the reductions must be attained language, and there are several other parts to it. I'm sure you probably have seen that language. And I'm wondering, is it your intention to accept the Senate language? And my concern is there's no cost containment language in it. So I'm wondering, I guess let's get back to the cost issue. What's the cost-benefit analysis? And if you could just shed a little light on me with what your end goal is. Are you thinking that we're going to move toward the Senate language or stay toward the House language?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, my experience in dealing with the Senate has caused me to feel that I never really want to move toward the Senate language.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, I think that's a really good instinct. Just overall, I'm looking at it, and I think I share a lot of the concerns that Representative Junkie, Representative Mahoney, Representative Severson, and others have. I think there's a lot of questions on here, and just overall, I'm concerned at the cost this is going to have versus what the benefit is. And I'm not
convinced. I don't see anything that convinces me that the cost that this is going to create in a lot of different forms, whether it be the utility costs or just some of the costs that Representative Mahoney talked about in terms of jobs. I don't think that that we're ready to move forward with this legislation, and I would hope members would join me in voting against this legislation for today.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, members, just a comment. You know, Representative Junkie asked where this came from, and from a conservative point of view, I think this comes from, if you ever watch Joe Suchere and you see him, he says, I see this picture. And I see a picture of a person sitting under a shade tree at Como Park. He's got a ponytail and a backpack and an encyclopedia, which makes him or her an expert on the environment. And they've got their laptop tuned into fantasyland.com. They know just enough about global warming and a few things about the environment to make them dangerous. And they produce legislation like this. This is moving through here so fast and it's so complex, I don't know if the author or the co-authors or the originators even understand it. And I just wish we had more time, because the effect this is going to have on the business and people in general moving through this fast without enough time to think about what we're doing and the cost this is going to encumber. It's just that it's too dramatic of a change in such a short time, and I just wish we could slow the whole process down and evaluate both sides of the issue and the side effects. But it looks like a fast train headed down the track. I wish we could derail.
Mr. Chair. The representatives, Cornish and Pepin, I would point out that really the only thing that this part of the bill does is require reporting, except for that section that we focused discussion on about small canister issue. I think that the intent simply is to recognize that there is a great potential here for something that is in very common use. And think about it. Every vehicle, there are, 800 and some million vehicles in this country, 800 and some million, I think it's around 850 million vehicles that all have, or not all of them, but a very high percentage of them have these substances contained within them. A lot of them are sitting in junkyards. The car is junk. What happens to this stuff? How much is going into the atmosphere? What are the effects of it? You know, I think it would have been worthwhile to have some idea of what was going on with the hydrofluorocarbons when we discovered, only after years of assuming that, wow, this is really neat stuff, it's totally inert, that it was having the effect on the ozone hole that is now well established. I don't see that there's any cost involved in this other than the cost of assessing the leakage and reporting it. This isn't, we're not talking about loss of jobs here or enormous cost to consumers or anything. We're talking about keeping track of something that's a very, that potentially has the potential for having a very significant impact on the environment. I don't see anything wrong with that. There may be some parts of the bill that we can argue about, and that, you know, I would hope that we advance this bill that we can have that discussion.
Certainly legitimate questions have been raised here, and I apologize. As I said, this part of the bill really is not my bill. And it's unfortunate that Representative Atkins couldn't be here to go through some of the details that he has worked out in bringing this bill forward. There are people here that could offer testimony if you want to take that up, but I really don't think that a simple reporting requirement is all that onerous.
Just going to mention, we do have some other bills on the agenda, and my intent, as soon as we're done with this one, is to drop down to Representative Kalin's bill, House File 3669, and give Representative Hilty a little rest on the next one. I haven't felt that I'm on a fast track this morning with all the questions that have come up. I'd much rather been on the Empire Builder, which used to be the crack train from here to Seattle. At any rate, I'll represent Mr. Cornish, who will finish his questions, and we have Anderson, Houseman, and Clark, and then I think at that point we'll make a decision on the bill so we can get to the Kalin bill. Representative Cornish.
Representative Hilty, I meant nothing to demean you about your knowledge of the bill, but I was talking about knowing the aftereffect and not you knowing the bill personally. I'm just talking about knowing what's coming on down the line, so I meant nothing towards you. It's just that it's a frustration of going from cheeseburgers to granola bars in 3 seconds. You know, I just wish we could pull it down and at least get some alfalfa sprouts in between a gradual, you know, a turnover here. So it's frustration. It's not just your bill, but all these environmental bills that are coming. We know that there's a problem. We've got to fix it. It's just that we're going to fix it so fast that in a few years we're going to have to back up and undo what we were fixing. That's all.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, how does this impact the larger commercial industrial companies in the state of Minnesota?
Representative Hilty.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't think it has any particular impact at all. The requirement for reporting is on the manufacturers of automobiles.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I think you go a little bit farther than that because you come bring in all these definitions and then you bring in gas manufacturers and you talk about purchases and things like that, and then you talk about federal agencies and the impact on that and who it's going to have to report to. It does include, of course, the mobile air conditioner, refrigerant, and vehicles that have them, but I have to believe that with all these definitions, it is just the nose of the camel under the tent to further push this legislation to include and have a major impact on our industry throughout the state of Minnesota, well, throughout this nation, because I have an article here from the Pepsi company industry who finally has decided to go green, and because of the pressure coming down on them and the fact that they have refrigerants that are used to filling their bottles and stuff with for Gatorade and for their Pepsi products and all the other things that they manufacture. And now they've become wise because they're such a big company that they've decided to join a big partnership of a United States Climate Action and to lobby the federal government to impose more regulations that curb greenhouse gas emissions and to push this on to other companies that are smaller than themselves, but they in turn reap the benefits because of that. They're smart, and they have the wherewithal to do that, but I see there is a major impact on not just the small individual as you per se or perceive supposedly through this bill, but it has a major impact on the rest of the industry throughout the state of Minnesota. So it may look innocuous on the face of it as we're only going after one area, but I really think this, as many people already said, this bill has a long way to go.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, the questions and comments seem to suggest that in this bill we're moving fast, that we're somehow fixing things. But I've looked at this really carefully, and in this particular bill, I don't think we're fixing anything yet. In the past, we established greenhouse gas reduction goals. Now, maybe we didn't mean it, but we did. That's what we did. And so the first part says, let's then have some progress reports on it. I mean, if we said we wanted to move in that direction, let's just have some progress reports. And the second part, in some ways, does even less, because it just sort of prepares us for being able to talk about what's happening, frankly, on the national level in some very much more extensive efforts, by, in our case, providing definitions, asking for public information programs, and that is as nearly as I could tell about it. So the sort of the opposite of moving fast and fixing things fast, in this particular bill, all we're saying is, well, what's happening? What's happening today? So I would suggest that we're perhaps misreading the words on the paper.
Representative Clark?
Mr. Chairman, I probably don't need to say too much more after Representative House's comments. I was just thinking that it would be important to know the history and how long we've been working on this issue, and it seems to me she kind of went through that, so I'll pass.
Okay, with that, Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 3661, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be placed in the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion
no.
Division has been requested. All those in favor, raise their hand. Motion carries 11 yeses and 5 noes. As I mentioned, members will now take up Representative Kalin's bill 3669. And I do want to try to be sure we get the Kalin and Knuth bills done today. Neither of them are on the committee, and in case that they waiting here. So Representative Kalin, Representative Hilty moves the Energy Finance and Policy Division report for House File 3669, the first committee engrossment. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carried, 1-0. We now have Representative Hilty's second motion. Representative Hilty, I made that other one for you or on your behalf as you were getting in your seat.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3669, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass and be placed in the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm hoping that I actually did just purposely move from the hot seat to the cooler chair here. House File 3669 is an energy financing mechanism for energy efficiency projects for local units of government.
Maybe I should ask you a question. I've got two amendments here by Representative Guilty on this bill. Do you want to take the amendments up to put the bill in the form that you'd like, or?
I'm aware of the A1 amendment. I think Mr. Elis is.
Do you want to take it up now or after you present the bill is the question?
I would like to take up the A1 amendment now, but then I'd also like to know what the other amendment is that you have in your hand.
Okay, that one you'll have to ask Representative Guilty about at the time.
Okay.
And,
I believe I know what that amendment is.
Oh, okay. That's.
You could do both amendments.
Okay. Representative Guilty moves then H3669A1. and this would, is this mainly a technical amendment, Representative Hilty, or maybe better explain it a little
that's
bit?
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair, but would defer to Representative Galen.
Okay, Representative Galen.
Amendment.
It is generally a technical agreement, or a technical amendment, but some things would have been asked for by the utilities, such as the change on line 1.4, just to make sure that we're not going to be getting into generation and transmission of renewable generation sources created by the state, but that they're just for the local buildings. The larger issue of the amendment is we're actually replacing the concept of a guaranteed energy savings with a supplemental cash flow agreement. Essentially, there's going to be an escrow fund that's going to back up the energy savings just in case anything were to go slightly awry. And something we worked out with the energy service companies like Honeywell and Johnson Controls, and I think that they're on board this, and I think that we can definitely live with this agreement. So that's the spirit of the A1 amendment.
The author endorses the amendment.
Yes, I do.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hilty then moves BEAO5. Representative Hilty.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And again, I believe this is the author's amendment.
And if the author wants to comment about it, is it? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, I ask that you adopt the AO5 amendment as well. One of the things we'd like to do is provide incentives. This bill is entirely built around providing incentives and more tools to local units of government and not more mandates. And what we'd like to do is create a Green Star Cities incentive award for cities and maybe even townships, school boards, counties, ultimately across the board, to give them a reward and a brand for achieving high level of energy efficiency and energy savings. And so this, we want to do it in such a way that works for all parties, including our the Department of Commerce, Pollution Control Agency, and all other stakeholders, and ask that you support the amendment so we can get that process started.
Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Kalen, if you'd just give us a quick review of the bill then.
Happy to do so, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3669, as I said, is a funded unmandate. Last year we passed the landmark energy efficiency and conservation bill, the Demand Efficiency Act that was in the Next Generation bill that established an energy savings goal statewide of 1.5% in electricity and natural gas, all sectors, knowing that the first fuel and the cheapest fuel to making our energy system reliable and to achieve the greenhouse gas reduction emissions that we want to is indeed to use less energy. Financing those projects for our local units of government and for the state, right now there are not as many tools as we would like, especially for sort of short-term and medium-term projects. And the Center for Energy and the Environment has initiated this lease purchase agreement financing structure. The Department of Commerce and Admin have both embraced it and been great partners in working out the details and working with private financers to create a standard lease purchase agreement. The League of Minnesota Cities, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, the school boards, and others have provided other meaningful input, saying that this would indeed be a useful tool to them. It's a voluntary tool. The state will be contracting for, or the local units of government with a standard state agreement will be packaging financial and technical services to help these local units of government and school districts to achieve energy saving projects. So you'll see the bill is divided into two sections. The first is a 16B section that's on page 2, and the second really is the 216C, the local unit of government section that starts on page 5. And the thing that I'd just like to point or direct your attention to as an example, on page 2, subdivision 3, the targeted technical services, it's those technical services that local units of government need some help and assistance in being able to finance and afford, and this would provide the way to do it. And we're going. The whole goal here is to save energy, but really to save money for our political subdivisions in the state and for the state of Minnesota. I think there may be some more technical questions about how the financing works. I do have some folks from Office of Energy Security and the Center for Energy and Environment who have worked this detail of the bill much more so than I, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any questions on the bill? Representative Leader? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Kalin, in Subdivision 10, I see your petroleum violation escrow funds. Can you tell me what that is?
I can give a little bit of background. I think Director Garvey from the Office of Energy and Security might be able to chime in a little bit more. It's a fund that was established, I believe, from violations from the 70s and established here in the state in the 80s, but I'll let Commissioner Garvey, Director Garvey, give more detail.
Garvey, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Edward Garvey, Director of the Office of Energy Security and Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Representative Leader, in the 1970s, the Exxon Oil Company overcharged the citizens of the country, and in a massive settlement with the corporation, they gave the state money through the state agents, through the state energy offices. This money went into the petroleum overcharge fund in 1983. It's been used as a revolving loan. It's been used as a backup for bonding, and it's being been used for funding of energy efficiency and conservation and those kinds of programs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me what the amount is annually that you have in the fund?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, representatives of the amount actually sort of fluctuates, but it's between, so it's my, the best of my most recent knowledge, it's between $6 and $8 million.
Thank you. Any further discussion, Representative? So what's the need for this?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Representative Thiessen, right now, as you might know, the energy service companies can provide longer-term, higher value, generally higher dollar amount projects that require a greater commitment from the local units of government to do energy efficiency projects. There are some smaller dollar amounts that, so let's say between $50,000 to $100,000 upwards of $500,000 or even $1 million, where either the energy service company is not the appropriate avenue, or actually going out and bonding for these projects is also not something that's appropriate for local units of government. This will provide a lease purchase agreement backed up by the petroleum overcharge funds that will then allow local units of government to essentially do it without bonding, but just enter into these agreements. And one more point, if I could, Representative Thiessen, Mr. Chair, is that the Department of Commerce, I believe, will be developing a master lease purchase agreement, so we're making it much, much easier for small school districts and smaller units of government to engage in these, to access this financing mechanism.
So, Mr. Chair, they could do this financing mechanism now, but it's the backup of the funds that gives it the ability to do it. That's the key to the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, yes.
Okay. Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Hilty removes his motion that House File 3669, the first committee engrossment, be recommended to pass as amended and be placed in the general register. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We're going to go down to Representative Knuth's bill next, House File 3195. She's been patiently waiting for the duration of the meeting. I quite honestly thought Representative Knuth thinks we're going to go a little bit faster than they did, but that's the nature of the legislative process, I guess. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
I understand we need a couple of motions here, though, to get the bill before us. Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I move the Energy Finance and Policy Division report for House File 3195, the first committee in Grossman.
Okay, the motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Hilty.
And Mr. Chair, I would move House File 3195, the first committee in Grossman, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, the motion is before us, and now we have an author's amendment here that I assume will put the bill in the form that the author would like it. And Representative Hilty.
Chair, I would move that amendment.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves Amendment 3195A35. And maybe if the author could, of the bill could tell us a little bit about the amendment. It's mainly to get the bill in the order that you like, but I think there is a substantive part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, what the amendment does is delete Section 2, Subdivision 2, the principles, and it, under the group of legislators that are going to be appointed to serve an advisory role to the Midwestern Governors Association negotiators or stakeholder group, which I can explain later. It gives them not just authority to participate as observers and to receive reports and offer advice over just the cap and trade, but of all the stakeholder groups that have been appointed by the Midwestern Governors Association. It tweaks line 2 or page 2, line 32, that any cap and trade agreement entered into is not effective in Minnesota until approved by the legislature, which was the original intent of that language, and just needed to be tightened up. And then finally, on page 5, it changes the way the appropriation works to line up with what we passed yesterday in the finance bill.
So. Okay, any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion carried. On the bill, then, Representative Knuth, any further comments? Before we go, there are other amendments to the desk.
There are, yes. I first in the home to do have the A35 amendment.
Oh, you didn't have a copy of it?
No.
Okay. Why don't you look it over, and if there's a problem, let us know, and we'll further discuss it. But the bill is still before us with the amendment on it, so. I made reference to the Empire Builder, which was the crack train to the West Coast, but I'm not trying to railroad anything.
Trying to get an A+, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Working hard, doing well.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3195 is a pretty straightforward bill. Essentially, it states that Minnesota would like to participate in a Midwestern cap and trade program negotiated by stakeholders in the Midwestern Governors Association process. It asks the Commissioner of Commerce to report back to the legislature. It appoints a few members of the legislature to serve in an advisory role, and it requires a couple studies, one about how some money that could revenue that could come from a cap and trade program would be governed, and then how the how a program with different aspects would affect our economy and the emissions. And a little background to the bill, last year in the legislature we passed, and the governor signed into law, targets for greenhouse gas emission reductions, and also some language about working towards a regional cap and trade program.
And this, the governor took that to heart and has been working with five other states and the premier of Manitoba to through the Midwestern Governors Association, and in November of last year signed the Midwestern Greenhouse Gas Accord, and I think the good work we did last year in renewable energy standard and conservation efficiency set the floor for that, and continuing that process, they are currently negotiating a model rule for a Midwestern cap and trade program. Stakeholders representing Minnesota have been appointed to take part in that process, and they are scheduled to come back with the model rule by November 15th of this year. And what this bill does is basically says the legislature should be getting information about this and should be offering advice about this. It's a pretty substantial policy discussion for the state of Minnesota, and I think as elected representatives in this state, we should be a part of that. And then the studies, and if you have some concerns about a cap and trade and you really think it's going to be negative for our economy, I would think you would support my bill, because the studies will try to suss out the real information and how a cap and trade program will impact both how we reach the goals we agreed upon last year in Minnesota and how the program will impact and benefit different parts of our economy. So with that, I would stand for questions.
Okay, and before we move forward, there's two amendments that were in the packet that are being withdrawn. I think they were originally intended to perhaps do author's amendments, that A31 and A29 will not be will not be offered. Representative Clark?
Okay, I'm trying to understand the one that I think was adopted, the A35. It doesn't fit unless I... It's the first committee engrossment, fifth committee engrossment, page 199 after it, there's no word yet.
And Mr. Chair, I've had several people ask me this question, and if you look, then are the numbers on your bill, or are they cut off? Because I've had several people ask this question.
Well, I can see what the numbers are.
1.9 on my version of the first committee engrossment, at least, is right under Section 2 Cap and Trade Program, Subdivision 1 and 10. That's line 1.9. So it's drafted to this and not... It's right in the way I read it.
Mr. Chair?
Maybe we should turn to Sam.
Mr. Chair, this was drafted to the first committee engrossment that was on the website, and I'm looking here for the copy that members...
I think it's because you're looking at the 9 infecting 19, I'm assuming, and we can't see the 9 on our page.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Mahoney is pointing out to me that on the version on the web, all of the, which is what I printed my copy from, all of the title and all that has line numbers, whereas in the version the committee has, those lines don't have numbers. I think that's the problem.
Mr. Chairman?
You're confusing the chair. I have numbers on what I have here.
Okay.
The first page, Mr. Chair, our first page numbers are
right. Yeah.
First
right. Page.
Okay. It's right.
It's right. I see. Okay. Maybe during the discussion of the bill, I see that the two staff members are working to clarify that. And
Mr. Chairman, I have a more general question then, I guess.
And then maybe once they get this clarified, then so that we'll take care of it so things are appropriate here in the end. Representative Clark.
Well, sir, I think I'm just trying to understand then, but is the intent of the author to remove the whole area that deals with intent and principles? Is that what you're doing?
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that is what the amendment does.
Yeah, and that's what I, when I said it was an author's amendment, that there was a substantive change in it, that's what I was referring to. Representative Clark?
Tim, and I guess I'd ask the author why. I mean, I find those principles pretty important, and I'm wondering why those are being removed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark. The principles have changed quite a lot in the process, and you know, I would have frankly liked stronger principles, but I'm working through the legislature, and as we move forward, we need to work with all parties involved, and I think that's important. I think I'd be happy to talk about the principles. I probably will talk about what a good cap and trade program should look like on the floor. We could do that today if you want in this committee. I think some members might want to be finishing up quickly. You know, and frankly, I am concerned as this program is negotiated that what comes back reflects the interests of individuals and consumers and not necessarily many of these in the way the industry serves those people, but not necessarily the industry interests themselves. And while that's negotiated, I will be paying attention and asking questions. And, you know, if I am appointed to be one of these senators' representatives, I will be following the process. I'll be following the process closely anyway. And that's, frankly, something as a legislature we have to decide next year with this model rule. What the cap and trade program looks like, and if we're okay with that in Minnesota. And so I was hoping we could, as a legislature, take a position as the negotiating continues. But I do think, and I'm working with fellow members and various stakeholders to move this bill forward.
Sure, I'm glad that you are, and I appreciate that. I just haven't had a chance, I guess, to participate too much in it yet. But the one principle that I really thought was really important that gives me a lot of confidence, I don't know if it's going to come back somewhere. Are you doing more principles in your final version? And it's not, I mean, I will point out the ones that I'm concerned about in particular. But are they going to reappear somewhere else then, or?
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark. I think there's concern about among members about principles generally, and so if you want to help me work on that, that would be great. And there may be some ways to put some of the things down in the study language, and we've tried to do that in terms of looking at both the costs and the benefits of a cap-and-trade program. And so this bill will have another stop at Ways and Means and again on the floor, so we can talk about that.
Mr. Chairman? I'll just wrap it up then with one, the one of the principles I thought was important, and maybe it is in the study, and if it's not, maybe we could figure out how to have it appear in there sometime in the future, it was principle number 6, providing for equity to communities at risk of disproportionate economic and environmental impacts. When I've had a lot of discussions about cap and trade, that's the one area that I want to make sure is always reflected, that particularly representing low-income communities of color, business people, I just want to make sure that is part of what we're always talking about. And I don't know, does it appear in the study language already, in your opinion, someplace?
Mr. Yale.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you look on page 5, lines 14 through 17, there are two parts under subdivision 4 called study criteria, which the language says specifically the study must discuss the extent to which expenditures from the fund meet the following goals. Goal number 5, equitably distribute the costs and benefits among state residents, communities, and economic sectors. Number 6, assist low-income and other consumers to reduce their costs associated with greenhouse gas emissions. That address, to some degree, I think, those principles.
Okay. I see another one, too, Mr. Chairman. I think on page 4, the
Mr.
9.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just to be, Mr. Chair and Representative Clark and thank you, Mr. Aleph. This study is looking at how we would use revenues from a cap-and-trade program that auctions allowances, and quite frankly, I think auctioning allowances to some degree is necessary for a cap-and-trade program that really fairly and equitably distributes the costs and benefits
of the program. And while there's not a principle about that in this bill, and the study may show something else, from the work that I've done and the background research that I've done, I do think an auction is necessary. And so that studying how that works is part of this bill. Thank you.
Any further discussion, Representative Hausman?
And then, Mr. Chair and Representative Coots, because we deleted the appropriation section, that means that the fiscal note we have is probably not relevant anymore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we actually didn't delete the appropriation. We changed the way it works because in the Energy Committee and in the Finance bill, through the Energy Finance bill, we changed the appropriation, so it doesn't assess additional $500,000. It takes already appropriated money, and that's being carried in the finance bill, but I want to carry it here, and it won't be appropriated twice, but it's good to have your belts and suspenders. And so the fiscal note reflects the cost of this study.
Mr. Chair, just to that point, as I mentioned in presenting that our division part of the finance bill yesterday, the funding for this is being carried in the finance bill.
Okay, any further discussion? Well, we do have some other amendments. Let's see, I think the first one I've got is an A2 amendment. I don't have any names apparently on some of these. 372982. Or no, excuse me, that's for a different bill here.
I think that's an amendment for my bill.
That was an amendment to your bill, yeah. We have the amendments for this bill. You said there were three or four. There. Okay. An A3, an A32. Anybody familiar with that one? 3159. Looks like it involves the Iron Range. It may be a Rukavina amendment. He's gone. Okay. This one may surface at some other point then, perhaps.
It's surfaced, but it's never been offered, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have A33, and I do have a name on this one. This is by Representative Steffen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My amendment is very short and very simple. It simply says the Minnesota corporate tax rate is lowered sufficiently to offset producer cost increases estimated in the study conducted under Section 4, Subdivision 2. Basically, what I'm trying to do here is there's going to be a significant cost. A cost to the utilities, which is going to be passed on to the ratepayers. And this is just saying that if we're going to do this, we're going to go forward with this, we ought to at least reduce the corporate tax rate so that there's some balance and so that there's some protection for the ratepayer.
Representative Pippen, we had a little discussion on the House floor yesterday. This committee has a rather broad jurisdiction because of the divisions that are attached to it, but we're really separate from the tax committee in this instance, so that's an amendment I'll have to rule out of order. Well, it's rule A34 by Representative Pippen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you might be familiar with this this bill or amendment. I've introduced it maybe once or twice before. What it is, it's very simple. All it does is to remove the outright ban that we have, and even looking at studying nuclear power in Minnesota. We're the only state that has an outright ban on even looking at new construction of nuclear power plants, and
I've got facts and facts of articles that lead me to believe that that is a big mistake. I'm not suggesting we need to build nuclear power plants tomorrow. But I would like to, I've passed out several articles in the past, which I'm sure nobody's read, but I do have a really good article I would like you to read going forward. I know some of you have given a lot of your concerns about nuclear power, and I think this article does a really good job, especially on the last three pages, two or three pages, that talk about some of the objections to nuclear power and sort of explain a little bit about why those objections really aren't what people think they are, why the fears are really rather unwarranted. So, members, all I'm looking to do is I'm looking to bring this issue to the experts so that they can study it. They could, you know, maybe it's 10 years, maybe it's 20 years, maybe they won't look at it for a few years. This is just simply to remove the outright ban. It's not that big of a deal. It just says this is one of the tools in the toolkit. That's all it does. And, you know, it's very hard for me to understand why this is such an alarmist amendment to folks for whatever, or bill for whatever reason, because it really doesn't do that much. All this does is puts us on a level playing field with what the other 49 states allow, and it doesn't call for any immediate impact. I don't believe there's any plans. I don't believe any of the utilities are looking to do anything right away. It's just trying to level out the playing field and say, you know, we're going to have to come up with a solution to our energy. We're going to have to meet our baseload needs. Coal power might not be the only way we want to get there. Renewables might not get us there. So let's just put all the tools that we have and let us look at everything. Let's study everything we have. And members, I know that a lot of you have been against it in the past, but, you know, I ask that you look at this and really have an open mind about looking more into nuclear. We're in a much different situation than we were years ago when people were concerned about Three Mile Island and Chernobyl and all that thing. Technology has changed so much, and I think there's been so much more research that addresses the concerns of nuclear power that I'm no expert on nuclear. I'm not going to pretend to be. Don't have a college background in it. All I'm trying to do is say, look, let the experts take a look at it. Let's just put all the options in there so that we can meet our energy demand in the future. That's all I'm trying to do, members, and I hope you support me.
Representative Stein.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Tepid, I have a suggested amendment to your amendment, and I'll point out that one of the things that has changed since Three Mile Island and since Chernobyl is that the existing nuclear plants are that many years older, 20-plus years older, I think, close to. But what I would, the amendment I would suggest is after the word plants, is I would add the language, provided the federal government has eliminated the liability limitations contained in the Price-Anderson Act.
Mr. Chair, are we on the A34 or the handwritten one?
The hand.
We're on the A34.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was the handwritten one. Where's the A? I didn't have the A34.
Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the amendment. Having been in the military, I know that now, from the naval standpoint, we are turning out ships that are nuclear powered on a regular basis. Certainly been on an aircraft carrier that was nuclear powered, and the other military ships that are coming out are using nuclear to a great extent. I also see, just like this article that Representative Pepin put out from Primus, that it's not only being used there in military in our own United States, but across the world. China, France, other countries are getting on board and utilizing and building the plants. And it looks like, from my standpoint, just in reading some of these articles, that we are slowly falling behind, and we will be, as Representative Pepper mentioned, in a crisis situation when it comes to the need of the extra energy that this nation needs and the state needs. So I support the amendment and look forward to hopefully passing it and getting on the bill.
The Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Representative Pepin. This particular amendment has been on the floor, and I've actually voted for this particular amendment But at this time, I don't think this is a wise thing. As you know, as a member of my committee, Representative Hilty and I are having the first of what I hope is a series of hearings on nuclear power, bringing in experts from both sides to have the conversation about what the new technologies, the new safety issues, what the pros and cons of them are. So although in principle I support this particular amendment, I think it's rather premature, and we need to do a whole lot more education, not only at the Capitol, but throughout the state, to allay fears to people, because right now people aren't comfortable with it. And I think this is just premature, and I would hope that the members of the committee would vote it down.
Representative Penn. Representative Penn.
Mr. Chairman, my apologies for being on the wrong amendment. The amendment I would suggest to the 834...
The chair has a few minutes to go as well, so don't...
What?
I was on the wrong amendment a little while ago as well, so don't worry about it.
It was a long night.
Right.
The amendment I would suggest to the 834 amendment would then just add the language saying no certificate, just right after 111, saying no certificate of need may be issued unless the federal government has eliminated the liability limitations contained in the Price-Anderson Act.
Moving that amendment?
Yes.
And does everybody have that?
To the Pepin Amendment.
Staff have the amendment, and everybody understand the amendment. If you could explain the amendment then.
Okay. What I would admit is that we have had this enormous subsidy to nuclear power. It's been in the Price-Anderson Act, which was initially passed, I think, in 1946, and I believe that and has been extended since then. And what the Price-Anderson Act does is put a liability limit on nuclear power plants that is on no other form of energy that we pursue. And that liability limit, of course, supersedes state law, so that nuclear power plants do not have to, people building nuclear power plants do not have to worry about their safety beyond the liability limit in the Price-Anderson Act, which is very, very low compared to the amount of damage that was done at either Three Mile Island or Chernobyl.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Speaker and Representative Kahn, well, I would adamantly oppose that. All I'm trying to do with my amendment is to look at the possibility of removing the ban so we can look at the possibility of nuclear. To ask us to not even look at nuclear power until we have a major change in federal policy would mean that we essentially would make the policy much worse, and it would mean we would never be able to change it. Mr. Chair, if you'd indulge me, I have Mr. Edward Garvey, from an assistant commissioner specializing in energy security. He's here. He's willing to testify and talk a little bit about this, just for a little bit more information for the members.
Is the question relative to the amendment that's before us, John Amendment?
Well, it's probably not relevant to the amendment, but I think that the if this amendment went on, it would be worse than the current law, in my estimation. If this amendment were to pass, then I would remove my amendment. I would just withdraw my amendment because it would make it worse than we already have it. So I guess I would like, before people vote on this amendment, I would
well,
I think
again,
this would be an appropriate time.
Is your question specific to the amendment of the commissioner?
My request for the commissioner to speak is just overall policy on what they would do.
If we'll dispose of the amendment one way or another, then first, and then if his comments or if you have a specific question of him are relevant, then we'll do that. But any further comments on Representative Kahn's amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I will point out that I'm sure you don't remember it, but in 1973, we did have a bill on nuclear power plants, which specifically did put this language into state law. So it was passed through the House Environment Committee and was just not considered beyond this. But the basic issue is, if nuclear power is so safe, why do we need this extraordinary liability
protection given by the federal government.
Okay, any further discussion on the con amendment?
Mr. Chair, I just have one question. Do you remember that bill in 1990?
Yes.
Representative Chunky, I was on the committee. I don't remember the specific bill, but I do remember a lot of discussion about nuclear power. That same session, however, I can tell you, if you wanted to digress a bit, about a bill, House File 495, with a school consolidation bill, which gets us far removed from nuclear energy.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kahn and I do have a little history together from time to time on some of these committees. Any further discussion, Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chair?
Amendment.
Willard Munger would smile down very favorably on us if we would have passed my amendment at this time.
Mr. Chair? So we have an endorsement from... I'm in Representative Munger's old office, so I... But that'll have some history to it at some point, I suppose, as well. Okay, Representative Stefan, a concluding comment on the con amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and this isn't actually on the con amendment. I was just going to point out you were both discussing, I have two things to say. You were discussing legislation that happened in 1973, and I apologize for not being here. I was actually somewhere between being potty trained and learning how to ride my bike, so I missed out on that conversation. And the second thing I have to say is last night during this very long, drawn-out session we had, I did leave my chair for maybe 3 or 4 minutes, and I happened to go back in the back room, and I looked at one of the old blue books, and I happened to pick up a 72-73 copies. And I have to say, lovely picture you had, Representative Carlson and Representative Kahn. I loved your haircut and a very nice outfit. And I encourage you all to go back a memory lane. And with that, that'll be my concluding comment.
Very good. Any further discussion on the con amendment? All those in favor then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carried. Representative Evans?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I still would like, if you would indulge us, just to get a little bit more feedback from the Assistant Commissioner, if you would not mind.
Well, if he has a quick comment or two, it has been a long meeting. I'll let the Commissioner come forward. That's fine. If you want to make a couple of brief comments, technically your amendment is still before us because you haven't withdrawn it. But being that you did indicate you're going to withdraw it, I don't suppose we want to spend a lot of time on it. Commissioner, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Edward Garvey, Director of the Office of Energy Security and Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. We do support the repeal of the moratorium on nuclear power. It's not an endorsement one way or the other on the technology itself. We believe that all technologies ought to be on the table as we think about our long-term energy resource capabilities. It's important that we think about these kind of technologies. It's important that we think about these in long-term. And when I say long-term, I'm thinking about these in decades, because that's how long it takes us to think through whether a large baseload facility such as a nuclear power plant is acceptable and appropriate for the state of Minnesota. Such as a facility or any of these kind of facilities, whether it be a coal plant or a wind plant or a biomass plant or a nuclear plant, goes through an extensive analytical review of its environmental effects, of its cost-benefits analysis, as well as its impacts for ratepayers and for the state of Minnesota and our electricity grid. So the removal of a moratorium would allow us to actually factor those kinds of considerations in, at least for nuclear power, as we think about it in a long-term perspective.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will withdraw that amendment, but I would like to offer the other amendment with a small technical change, the handwritten amendment.
That one is an amendment, I'm told by staff, that to a section that the office amendment withdrew. Or struck.
Right, longer. And that would be why I would make a small technical change of page numbers, reference numbers.
Then you're going to do what then before move the amendment?
My oral amendment would be... where it says in the second paragraph where it says page 3, change that to page, or it says, excuse me, it says page 2, change that to 3, and then it says after line 9, change that to line 10. And then the next section I already crossed off, but it would be section 3. So it would be under the Subdivision 1 Governance Study of the University of Minnesota.
And Mr. Chair, if you'd like me to explain it, basically this would just add to that
you
section.
Move the amendment,
I'll move the amendment.
Modified.
As modified.
Or incorporate those changes, Representative Pepin, on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this would just put this in a section of the language of the bill under the governance study that says the University of Minnesota shall issue a request for proposals for a study that describes and analyzes several options regarding how decisions on expenditures of revenues captured by any cap and trade program may be made. The study must examine. So my amendment would add a new section that says must examine repealing the ban on issuing a certificate of need for construction of new nuclear powered electric generating plants. So this would just say this is a lot less than the last amendment even, and all it would say is the University of Minnesota study would look at this as one of the issues, one of the things that they looked at.
The amendment is before us. Representative Kahn?
Mr. Chairman, well, then I'll go back to the first one, amendment that I had. I would add at the end of that, at the end of the language on the handwritten one, in the same, I would add, provided the language saying, provided the federal government has eliminated the liability limitations contained in the Price-Anderson Act. Again, unless we deal with the true problems.
Representative Kahn, you said you'd go back. Are you moving that?
Yes, I would move that.
To the Pepin amendment, I would move
language that says, provided the federal government has eliminated the liability limitations contained in the Price-Anderson Act.
And I think everybody understands that one, being that it was the amendment on the previous one. So any discussion on the Kahn amendment? Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I'm starting to get mad. All I'm asking to do is to have the University of Minnesota be able to look at this by putting on adding to the amendment to say that we have to wait till the federal government, we're waiting for a change from the federal government. I don't know that I don't even see how that would be possible. It's a ridiculous amendment to a very minor change. Give me a break, people. All we're looking for is a study to possibly at some point look at nuclear power in the future. When we just heard the commissioner talking about they would like to be able to look at it, have one of the tools in the tool chest. Come on. Look at the people of Minnesota are going to see what you're doing here. This is just outrageous. I do not understand how we could do this, and I would vehemently oppose the Kahn amendment to my amendment.
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, I guess that my remarks would not be addressed to the Kahn amendment, but I would point out that both Representative Mahoney and I have already made a commitment to pursue studying the feasibility of nuclear power in Minnesota, not only with the joint hearing that we have scheduled a couple weeks from now, but also through the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, or should it, as is my desire, become an energy commission, we do have a commitment to make that study. And I would point out also that the amendment as it is currently structured is tacked on to a study of how expenditures of revenues captured may be made. And I don't see how the amendment fits that section of the bill at all.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, I think this vote is the same as the last vote that we had, and I think there's no reason why the university, as they're doing that, aside from what Representative Hilton said about the chance of the construction of the amendment, how they can't also get into the conversation about the Price-Anderson Act.
Okay, Representative Clark.
Chair, I'm just trying to understand the amendment. Maybe I missed it, but does it still include the words repealing the ban?
Yes.
Okay, well, so then it's not.
Studying repealing the ban.
Studying repealing the ban.
In front of it?
It's in this. Are you looking at the right amendment here?
Yeah.
I didn't see the word studying.
You might not have caught the technical changes, Representative Clark. It's page 3 after line 10, and it would add a third section.
Yeah, that 7 was struck, and it became a 3, right?
And Mr. Chairman, the word studying was inserted before
repealing.
Studying, before repealing. Okay. I did miss the word study.
Well, Representative Clark, it's actually on Subdivision 1. It's underneath the subdivision that says government study. So it would be the third. You see here it says on 3.5, that's the first one. 3.7 is the second one, and this would be on line 3. After 3.10, it would be the third.
Do we have Representative?
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, in your study, are you going to have Representative Kahn's amendment before you too, and prevent you from going forward with your study with this amendment that Representative Kahn wants to have on this amendment?
Representative Hilty.
Chair, Representative Anderson. We've already made a commitment to do this. We have not consulted Representative Kahn, and I don't believe there would be any legislation involved in this that would afford Representative Kahn the opportunity to offer an amendment.
Any further discussion on the Kahn amendment? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Chair is in doubt. All those in favor of the Kahn amendment, please raise your hand. No. Raise your hand. Okay, the motion prevails 16-9. So now we have the Pepin amendment before us as amended. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, I do appreciate Representative Mahoney and Representative Hilty allowing a day to look at some of these issues on April 17th. I have appreciated working with both the members, especially Representative Mahoney. We'll have some, hopefully we'll have some good discussion and open discussion. But I did want to point out that we actually did pass a legislation for a study, and I never got the report on what happened with that study. It was supposed to be convened. Never heard a word on what happened. Don't know how it was done. You know, I'm glad. I put in a hearing request on this on February 20th of last year, so I'm glad that a year and a half later, you know, we'll get a hearing on probably not my bill. Probably it's just going to be looking at you know, an informational hearing, since obviously we're past all the deadlines. So I do appreciate it, but you know, we passed the study, and as far as I can tell, I either haven't gotten the report for whatever reason, you know, we haven't exactly been you know, moving forward on even the study language.
Okay. And further, you can withdraw.
Mr. Chair, I will withdraw the amendment.
The amendment is withdrawn. So now we have the we're back on the bill. Any further discussion on the bill?
Oh, on the bill.
We're done with the amendment. She withdrew the amendment. Yeah. So
you can talk about it more if you like.
Okay, we will renew the motion then, whereby. Going to find my place here.
It would be my motion.
Yeah, the Hilty motion that House File 3195, the First Committee at Grossman, be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Now, I do have a question. Did staff get all of these lines straightened out on that First Amendment so the bill is in proper order as we move it forward? Okay, any further discussion? Saying none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We do have two bills remaining on the agenda, one by Representative Solberg. We'll take that one next, and I'll be turning the chair over to Representative Sertich at this point.
Yeah.
Representative Silver, before we get to your bill, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, since it is a Friday and we're sleep deprived, and there was a reference made to the blue book containing the pictures of Representative Conner and Representative Carlson, I have fetched that blue book and passed it around and I've tabbed the pictures of those two so you can enjoy yourself. I just ask that at the end of the hearing you get back to me. One of my dorky hobbies is collecting blue books, so I have quite a collection in my office, and I happen to have the 73-74, so I ran up and got it. And for your pleasure and amusement, I'll pass it around.
All right. And just point of fact, I didn't hear the whole story, but I didn't know if you mentioned Representative Yaros is also in the book as well. So look under the G or the J for Jaros. It's a long morning already. Representative Solberg moves the State Government Finance Division report for House File 3493. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Solberg now moves House File 3493 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. Representative Solberg, welcome to your committee.
That's my committee.
It's you sit on it, so it's yours.
Okay.
It's just as much yours as it is mine because Carlson's out of the room.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair and members, if there's any technical concerns or questions, John Kerr from the Department of Homeland Security is here. But in the special session we had for the flood disaster in southeastern Minnesota, as we went through that procedure, it was an error was discovered, as I understand it, in the final version of the bill. And what it really said was that, and it was discovered after the bill had left the House, was in the Senate, and the Senate attempted to correct it there. And it was a difficulty in correcting because we were already gone. So what this does is merely correct that particular error so that we prevent people from having to pay back some funds from federal funds in Homeland Security. Now, the department has been managing that with the contention from an agreement with the federal government that we would pass this legislation. I think that's as simple as it can get in a short period of time.
Any questions? Seeing none, Representative Solberg renews his motion that House File 3493 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Solberg. Mm-hmm. Representative Hilty, I believe you have the final bill.
I do, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Representative Hilty, I believe, moves House File 3729, first engrossment, recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I believe, Representative Hilty, you have a couple of author's amendments.
I do, Mr. Chair. If members have those.
Which would you like to take
amendments?
First?
Sorting out here, Mr. Chair.
I see an A1 and an A2. Should we just start with the A1, Representative Hilty?
Let's start with the A2. I believe that.
Okay, Representative Hilty moves the A2 amendment. Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, this really just gets the bill in the shape that I would like to have it. The first part of the amendment makes explicit what is implied in the mission of the Energy Commission that public testimony be solicited and considered. And second part clears up an ambiguity with regard to the Commerce Department's ability to make assessments, and that's all that amendment does, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, your amendment, talk about vague. I don't understand when you say the commission shall, when feasible. Why don't you just say the commission shall solicit and consider public testimony regarding blah, blah, blah? Why do you need when feasible?
Representative.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the reason for the when feasible is simply that sometimes it might not be. And without that sort of flexibility built into the amendment, the implication might be that with any issue that came before the commission in any discussion, we would be obliged to do that. There, I'm sure, would be some situations in which it would not be possible, or that we wouldn't necessarily know how to go about soliciting public opinion. So it's just the intent here is just to make it clear that insofar as it's possible, the commission should do that, but that it would not be obliged to do that in any circumstance, whether it was possible or not.
Well, Mr.
Anderson.
Let's go. Junkie made a statement a couple, two, three bills earlier about having the MPCA here to testify on a bill, and it wasn't, they weren't available to testify, and he had some concerns about that bill that was up here. Now you're putting this here in, and so I'm saying, does this bill, then, if you don't have testimony, then we can't do the bill? Is that what we're going to say? We can't, the commission is not going to go forward with the information until we have some kind of testimony that's been taken so that we can justify what we're doing? Or, you know, we'll pass this bill if the MPCA shows up. If it doesn't show up, then we're not going to pass it? I mean,
well,
it's kind of a very vague
scenario. Representative Anderson, the commission, perhaps I should explain the bill first, Mr. Chair, if you would indulge me in that. House File 3729 does basically is expand the mission of an already existing legislative entity called the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. I propose this change in the existing legislation because I think it has become apparent that energy issues in the state go beyond simply considerations of how electricity is generated and distributed in the state, which is basically the charge of the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force. We need to be considering other energy issues and from a broader perspective than is the mission of the current task force. So what the bill does basically is simply to indulge my use of the term morph the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force into the Energy Commission. The Energy Commission, Representative Anderson, like the Electric Energy Task Force, would not pass bills. It considers policy and planning and energy issues in the state and would make recommendations to the legislature. And as far as the amendment is concerned, part of the amendment to what you initially objected, the term when feasible, is intended to accomplish exactly what your later statement seems to suggest was a problem. That is that we couldn't act on anything without having testimony. That's exactly why when feasible is in the amendment.
President Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, my concern is that you've got that in there. I don't know why we just don't put shall solicit and consider public testimony, because you also then in the bill you have subpoena power. According to the commission, they may subpoena persons regarding the testimony. Well, I don't know. To me, it's words that need to be refined.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson.
Representative Hilty.
task force, as it's currently structured, is not obliged to take any kind of testimony at all. This amendment is simply intended to suggest that in the restructuring of the task force into a commission, it should recognize that when desirable, it's a good thing to take testimony.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Representative Hilton renews his motion on the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hilton moves the A1 amendment. Representative Hilton.
Mr. Chair, what this does is just the commission, as does the task force currently, would have assessment authority. The commission's proposal expands the assessment authority, not the amount to be success, but the entities to be success, to include other energy sources, namely delivered fuels. And it was pointed out by the Department of Commerce that while they could do this easily enough if they had the information, they don't have the information. And what this amendment would do is give them the ability to gather the information they need about gross sales in the state in order to make the assessment.
Any questions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, members, I think I pretty much did describe the bill and its intent. I should point out that while the bill provides for the same number of members as the current Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, it is a little bit more specific about that membership, in that it does specify that appointees from the House and the Senate must include the chair of the committee with primary jurisdiction over energy policy, and the chair or another member of each of the committees with primary jurisdiction over environmental policy, agricultural policy, and transportation policy, and also a legislator who is a member of the Next Generation Energy Board. Currently, there are two legislators that are statutorily appointed to the Next Generation Energy Board, and one of them is the chair of the Energy Policy Committee. It kind of narrows the choices down quite a bit.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, does the governor support this proposal, or have you had a chance to talk with anybody in the department as far as this commission?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I haven't had very many chances to discuss legislation with the governor, but I have had the discussion with the Office of Energy Security, and I have not had them jumping up and down in response to it, but I don't believe that they oppose it in any way.
Any further discussion? President Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. I'm just wondering why, and I missed part of it because I had to run off of something quick, why the Legislative Energy Commission is established replacing the Electric Energy Task Force when, first of all, why one is replacing the other, and then second, why is the commission necessary? We already have the Department of Commerce, the Department of Energy Security. I'm trying to, it just seems like we're adding more bureaucracy. I'm trying to understand what this is getting at.
Mr. Chair, the reason for the proposed change, as I described earlier, is that I believe that energy issues go beyond simply consideration of the generation of electricity. I can give you an example related to natural gas, and actually Representative Beard
has a bill proposing to prohibit the use of natural gas for the generation of electricity, and it's a discussion that I promised him that we would have. The reason that he brought that forward is that, and this was pointed out in a hearing that we had recently by one of our testifiers, that natural gas has a certain substantial energy potential and energy content. When we use that natural gas to generate electricity, and then we turn around and use the natural gas in generating electricity is turned into heat energy, and then we turn around and use the electricity that is generated to heat something, there's a significant loss of the original energy potential in the gas through that process that would not be lost if you simply use it directly to heat what you end up using the electricity to heat. There are questions like that that are not questions that it's the responsibility of the Department of Commerce or the PUC or anybody other than people that are responsible for making policy in the state to consider. And what this commission is intended to do is make policy considerations about our energy future, about a vision for the future, which I should point out would include considerations of the possibility of nuclear energy. We've had that discussion, and I think that it's perfectly appropriate to continue the discussion.
President Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hilty. I guess I'm not quite sure why we couldn't fit this in to the Department of Commerce and why we need to start a new commission. This commission is going to add an excess of, it's going to cost an excess of $250,000. And it's going to be passed on to public utilities who are going to pass it on to us, the ratepayers. Well, so I guess just overall, you know, I just hate to see what our energy bills are going to be after we're done with all this policy. It's, you know, it's just really hard for me to grasp. And, you know, and I don't know if that's going to work out, but, you know, I know how utilities work. They don't just do it out of the goodness of their heart, nor should they. They have to pass it on. And we're just, you know, we're just making so many changes to our policy. It's frightening to me. And, you know, putting on another level of bureaucracy and not exploring other options as to where else we might want to, you know, perhaps fund some of this at a smaller cost. You know, it's disappointing. I would have to be speaking opposition to this bill.
Representative
Church, Representative Pepin, he's not creating a new, he's replacing an existing. I think Representative Hackbarth and other members around here, maybe Leader, have sat on this. This is a current standing commission. He's just redefining who's on it and broadening the scope from electricity to energy. So we're not creating anything new in my mind. We're actually replacing a group that's already there. So as far as your cost goes, it's an ongoing cost already.
Now, if we cut it, there'd be less. I agree with you. But it's an ongoing group at this point in time. As you see in the title, we're abolishing the Electric Energy Task Force and replacing it with this.
Any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hilty, do you know what the costs have been up to this point of the old, what the Legislative Energy Commission, what they were charging to do the same type of thing that you're now recreating into the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force that you're doing away with?
Representative Hilty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have those figures in front of me. I can tell you that there have been years in which the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force apparently saw no reason to meet at all. And I believe also that in the past, the members of the task force have been invited to tour the potential nuclear waste storage facility at Yucca Mountain, which is conveniently located near Las Vegas, I think that the members have made that tour at least two and maybe three times, and it's not my intention to pursue that particular endeavor, Representative Anderson. I think that there's serious work that the Energy Commission needs to be considering, particularly in light of our global energy situation, and it would be my intention that we actually do some serious work. So I do anticipate that the commission would use the assessment power that it has had in the past, and I have to say has not used to the extent that I would have liked to have seen it used.
Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hilty moves renews his motion that House File 3729, First Engrossment, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nope.
Motion prevails. Members, the next meeting of this committee will be 1 p.m. Tuesday, April 8th. Have a safe and restful weekend. We're adjourned.